I'm ready.
Oh, good morning. 106. And yes, Nick D is not here for the Nick D diehards and for the fans. He's a little under the weather tonight, Tom. Is that the deal?
That is correct, sir.
So, Mark Harmon, yours truly, is here for you, taking you on the ride. We had a very busy show. We're going to talk about competitive eating at 1:30. My guy Frank Bartoletti's going to be in here. Tom, you aware that it's National Chicken Wing Day today?
I did not know that.
It is National Chicken Wing Day today.
Well, I know what I'm doing for dinner later.
See, we've got our guy, the competitive eater of all time, Joey Chestnut, who is going to be on the show. I might play a little bit. I talked to Joey. Might play some of that. And Joey is going to be eating as many chicken wings as he possibly can in a 12-hour span today. He's shooting for 350 chicken wings.
And that's bone-in.
I am assuming it's bone-in, yes. Yeah. That's just brutal. I can't imagine. I think he's actually going to do more. 12 hours? I mean, how many chicken wings do you think you could eat in an hour? If you ate one, let's just break this down here. We got 60 minutes in an hour. You eat, I don't know, 3 wings every 5 minutes? Is that too many? That would be 36 in an hour. You times that by 10, that's 360. Add on another, let's just call it 70. He's at 430. I think he's going to eat over 400 wings.
Well, he's also playing the long game here.
Right.
He can't come out of the gate too hot. Because then what if you fill up too early? If he's going to eat as many as he can over the course of 12 hours, he's got to be thinking ahead.
The dude's going to starve himself for 2 days. That's a strategy. Something along those lines. He normally goes on the starve thing for a day and a half, 2 days. So he's going to be completely empty, ready to roll. And here I'm going. Now, he normally does 75 hot dogs in 10 minutes. This is going to be a 12-hour thing. That stomach is maybe not. I get a little sick thinking about it. But I'm going to say it's going to be. There will be a news report coming out here that when Nick comes in here tomorrow night, you can mention that he's the Joey Chestnut just ate 478 wings and Carmen nailed it. Hopefully it'll be better tomorrow night. All right, here. I want to start with a story. I was doing the 10 p.m. to 1 a.m. shift last week. And, Vic Vaughn, are you still there?
Standing by.
Okay. Now, all right. We got to get to the bottom of this, Vic Vaughn. And I want to say I was the first. I was out in front of this one. And, you know, we had a guy who rode into this city by the name of Frank Robb, the alligator guy. No one in all of Chicago could figure out how to get this alligator out of the Humboldt Park Lagoon. We didn't have anybody in the whole city who could do it. And I didn't like that. We had the great alligator Bob out there. They didn't set it up that alligator Bob could have the peace and quiet that he needed. And so we brought in Frank Robb. Frank Robb's here for all of 6 minutes. Next thing you know, the gator's in his hands. He's singing the seventh inning stretch at Wrigley Field or wherever. He's throwing out the first pitch. He's on all the shows. Now he goes back down to Florida. And him and the gator are having a reunion like the gator knows who he is. Tom, did you get any sniff that this didn't seem right to you?
No. It seemed legit.
Vic, did you buy it?
Yeah, I think I did. As far as this guy coming from Florida to get the thing, what do you think he brought it with him and
I
slid
don't know.
It in there?
All of a sudden, under the cover of darkness, there it is. Boom, he's got the alligator. Alligator Bob, like the greatest alligator guy in the history of the city, he can't find him. Rob's here for 3 minutes. Next thing you know, he's got the alligator. And I just was like, this just feels like something's just amiss. And now, breaking today, and I think they were probably listening to me the other night and they knew something was up here, but their police are investigating whether a second alligator was caught in the Humboldt Park Lagoon, or perhaps he was just brought there. There is skepticism over whether a man who claimed to have caught a second alligator in the Humboldt Park Lagoon, this was on Saturday night, actually found the reptile. A Facebook video surfaced Saturday night showing the group of men in Humboldt Park with an alligator they say they caught in the lagoon. The video, the man's holding approximately a three feet long alligator. Said he was a neighbor of the park, saw an alligator, and went out Saturday night to catch it. Top spokesman for Chicago Police, Anthony Guglielmi. Close enough?
Pretty close.
Okay, thank you. Said the Chicago Park District learned about the capture around 9:30 on Saturday. He said the two men told police they caught an alligator together and wrapped its snout in black tape. He said the man gave conflicting statements to police on the scene. That's what he's saying. One of the men claiming to have caught the gator had been in contact with Frank Robb over social media during and since the initial alligator incident and made comments indicating he and his brother had almost caught the first alligator. All right, so Robb is the Florida guy, right, who came in here to save the thing.
Mm-hmm.
He supposedly caught it. I'm telling you, that alligator, there's no way in my mind that Alligator Bob, legendary Bob, who should be on every alligator show there is, if he couldn't get it done, the whole alligator being in that Humboldt, do you understand how much coverage and news was going on around the alligator? I mean, that thing united the city, but then nobody could catch right here, and it was dragging on here. Just bring in the guy. Look, bring in Frank Robb. Give me a bearded guy who looks like all he does is capture alligators. Get him in here. We'll put a fence around it. The next thing you know, we'll have him show up with his alligator, and he'll say he caught it, and we'll send him home. Anybody?
I gotta ask though.
Anybody buying this? 312-981-7200. Who thinks that this was a hoax?
I gotta ask, what's the goal though? What's the end game? Because if it's a conspiracy, there's got to be some sort of end game, you know?
Well, the end game is that somebody loves Frank Robb. It was like, look, dude, just come up here, wear that white coat. We'll act like there's some alligator going on, and then you're gonna be famous, man. You're going to be on all the TV shows. We're going to put you on. You're going to be on the Tonight Show. You're going to go to Wrigley Field. You're going to throw out the first pitch. We're going to get you sweet tickets. You're going to be a hero. And then when you go back to Florida, everyone in Florida is going to think you're the king of the whole world. And anytime there's an alligator, they're going to call you. You're going to be a millionaire.
Enough gator incidences where he might be a millionaire.
I mean, did you know the name Frank Robb 2 weeks ago?
No, I didn't.
So now
who would have? But I can't imagine that someone would be willing to orchestrate this on such a level just so that they could help out their buddy Frank Robb. And, you know, Frank Robb seems like a real nice guy. He seems like a great guy.
He does. That's the whole thing. And maybe he is. Maybe he's just having a fun, he's just a fun loving guy.
I just don't get how someone would go through all this trouble. Although, if you were correct, I don't know what would happen. My head might explode. That would be insane.
Vic, you're a longtime news guy. You know what goes on behind the scenes. You know what's real and what's not.
I'm not with you on this one at all.
The second gator, yes. It's obvious. The second gator is not. It's
the second
gator is
not real?
It is not. Well, it's a real gator, yeah.
A real gator. They just walked out a gator to the pond and said, hey, we caught another gator?
I am very curious where they would have gotten that second gator, though. But it seems suspect.
Apparently, the police agree with Tom. There's inconsistencies, apparently, in the story by this latest one.
So these guys, so what's their end game? They got up in the middle of the night and said, like, look, we're going to stage that we caught another alligator. We're going to call up the police, and we're going to get famous. Is that what they were doing?
Well, I mean, it fits the perfect, the usual copycatter. I mean,
yeah,
that right? makes Just more falls sense. Right into that whole
the usual copycatter, right. huh?
I mean, they always look for those type of things. Robb sure got a lot of media attention, so
these guys
copycatter maybe.
Mm-hmm. These guys wanted to be the next Frank Robb.
So if the first one was Gator Watch, is this since this is you know a little bit suspect, a little bit you know strange? Is this going to be Gatorgate? We've had Gator Watch,
and we're all Gator haters. What is you know?
I mean, see,
it's got to rhyme if you want any media traction at all, right?
Gatorgate. Gator fraud. Fraud gator. Illegal gator. What's the gator? I'm terrible at this. I'll take suggestions. 312-981-7200. Something's going on here. All I know is I came on the radio last week, and I'm like, this just doesn't make sense. And because they were celebrating, the Florida, what really got me going for the record, the Florida news was like, well, up in the Windy City, they don't really know how to handle alligators, but we do. They know. They don't know that stuff in Chi-Town. They call it Chi-Town, Tom. You ever call it Chi-Town?
No one has ever from this city referred to Chicago as Chi-Town.
Right, and these Florida peeps, hang on a second. I want to see if I can find this audio to send to you. Well, maybe we should take a quick timeout, and we'll come back and we'll play it. What do you think about that?
That sounds good to me.
Does that sound good? I know I have it somewhere. I want to play this audio, and you tell me what's going on. Gator Watch. Gator Fraud. 312-981-7200. Who knows what's going on? Somebody knows what's going on out there. You can just call us, and let's all figure this out together. 720 WGN.
Amos Moses was a Cajun. He lived by himself in the swamp. They hunted alligator for a living. They just knock him in the head with a stump.
Something's going on here. Second gator found in the Humboldt Park Lagoon. Tom Hush, you play the greatest music in the history of WGN Radio, so thank you.
I do what I can.
Who was that?
That's a little Jerry Reed.
Jerry Reed out of nowhere? Was that a YouTube search, or do you know Jerry Reed and just pulled that out?
I mean, I just know Jerry Reed.
You know Jerry Reed?
Well, not personally.
But you know his tunes.
I watched Smokey and the Bandit enough.
Okay. That's a Smokey and the Bandit tune?
Well, Jerry Reed is in Smokey and the Bandit, and he did, you know, Eastbound and Down.
Yeah, of course.
Loaded up and trucking.
That's him. Aw. See, that's why I love coming in here. Not only do I get to do the show, I get to learn things from Tom Hush. This is huge. All right, hang on a second here before we get to the phones. 312-981-7200. What's going on with the second gator? Let me just read this again, because maybe I'm not that smart here. A man claims he caught an alligator Saturday night in the Humboldt Park Lagoon, reading the news story, where the now-famed Chance the Snapper was caught earlier this month. Video goes live on Facebook. Man's holding a 3-foot-long gator, so we're all on the same team. Video includes the man telling people to hook the gator. All right. Police arrived. They found the man holding the gator, talking about it live on Facebook. So here the police are, and he's talking live. Second person in the scene, conflicting statements. Okay, so they didn't have their ducks in a row. According to officials, this is where I get confused. One of the men said he had previously been in contact on social media with Frank Robb, the Florida-based crocodile hunter. All right? Comments were made by one of the men indicating he and his brother almost had caught the first alligator. And then here's the comment that's confusing. Based on the inconsistencies and information provided by Frank Robb, the subjects were taken into custody on the scene and transported to the district. Robb told police that, quote, in his professional opinion, the animal was juvenile and could not have been in the lagoon for any period of time. Robb further stated that his investigation on scene revealed only one alligator in the lagoon, which was the one captured prior to this incident. So they're calling up Frank Robb, and Rob's like, no. That was the only gator. I checked the entire lagoon. There could be no other gators. I'm Frank Robb. Listen to me. It's impossible that there was another gator. Now, I don't want to tarnish Frank Robb's name here, but you're telling me that he absolutely knew there was no other gators in the entire lagoon? He's been here for all of 5 minutes? Doesn't that seem a little presumptuous there?
Well, how big is the lagoon? It's a lagoon. It can't be that big.
Well, here, do you have the news report that I sent you?
Yes, sir.
Okay, hold on. Play this report.
News for Jack's anchor Bruce Hamilton spoke with a man Chicago dubs a hero, gator trapper Frank Robb.
Gators in Florida are pretty common. In Chicago, not so much. So you can imagine finding someone to wrangle a gator in the Windy City isn't so easy. So when the need to capture an alligator navigating Chicago area waterways came up, the search turned to our neck of the woods, and Frank Robb's name came up.
We didn't need
you. Chance?
That was quite an ordeal. So when you look at this situation that was going on up there, it's not just that one small lagoon. It's several lagoons attached to that one lagoon. And really, an absolute blessing and the grace of God that we actually found him, because it was a needle in a haystack.
Yep. Grace of God, multiple lagoons. He's on the news. Chicago, they couldn't catch a gator. Nobody up there could do. We had to call Robb. And I mean, they continued, by the way, on that whole report just to completely slander this city and our ability to catch a gator, as if nobody in here could catch a gator. And but now he's saying multiple lagoons, needle and haystack. Now he needle and haystack. Now he knows that there's no other alligators in there. How does he know? You're with me, Tom.
I'm hearing what you're saying, man. Okay. I hear what you're saying.
I mean, hey, Lulu, thank you for calling. 720.
Hey, Mark.
What's up, Lulu?
Are you losing sleep over this story?
I don't know if I'm losing sleep, Lulu, but I want to get to the bottom of this. Did you hear me the other night, Lulu?
Simple.
Okay.
Yes, I did hear you the other night. This is very simple.
Yes.
The first gator was in the lagoon.
Uh-huh.
And all these people came out to see the gator. And Bob couldn't catch the gator because there was too many people around. And as time went on, the powers that be were thinking, okay, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? So they started to fence off the park. A lot of the people went away, but the alligator still wasn't caught. And so that's why they brought Frank Robb up. And he was able to catch the gator right away because now the lagoon was quiet.
So you're buying into the quiet lagoon theory, huh, Lulu?
Yes, but Bob didn't get enough credit for the job he tried to do during the times when it was too noisy.
Mm-hmm.
But then these two yokels that have this second gator...
Hey, Lulu, don't be calling them yokels. You don't know what's going on here necessarily, but go ahead.
Well, they either had a friend that needed to get rid of a gator or it belonged to one of them, and it was only 3 feet long. They taped his mouth before they took him to the lagoon and went over there because they wanted their 15 minutes of fame, and that's why the second gator...
Lulu, let me ask you a question, because you seem, and Lulu, we've talked many times, and so I'm always appreciate your input here, Lulu.
Yeah.
If you had a 3-foot gator that you wanted to get rid of, do you think your strategy as the intelligent Lulu would be to show up at the Humboldt Park Lagoon, go on Facebook, and welcome the police to come in there, and all of a sudden now you're at the police station and they think you're nuts? Why would anybody put themselves in that position, Lulu? That doesn't make sense, does it?
Why do you think I call them yokels? That's the end of the story. Those guys are busted.
So you think that these yokels, as you so elegantly put it, thought that we got to get rid of this alligator. Here's the way to do it. Let's go to the lagoon. Let's get the phone out. Let's get the Facebook Live going. We'll all smile for the camera, and then they'll take the alligator away, and this pet that we bought that once was a foot is now 3 feet, and they'll take it away and put it in some animal heaven on earth.
Exactly. Exactly.
I don't know.
And they wanted put the first, you know, toss out the first pitch at the Cubs game or whatever. They wanted to get in on the fun that Frank Robb got into. And I think he was a pretty classy guy. He had a lot of fun while he was here.
Didn't he just... Wasn't he a little bit stoic, though, Lulu? Did you really get a feeling for Frank Robb? He just kind of sat up in his seat and he had his whole Frank Robb look going. I don't know. I didn't get a deep sense of who Frank Robb was. Did you?
Well, you know, I never saw anything. I only heard about him, so I don't have a picture of him in my mind.
Oh.
But I heard him, and he was really sounded down to earth.
Yeah,
he was thrilled to be here, and he just happened to come in at the right time.
Okay. All right, Lulu.
All right.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks for calling.
Go to sleep now and quit worrying.
I got to work till 5 a.m. here, Lulu.
Okay.
Thank you. See ya.
Goodbye.
Can't go to sleep. Come on, Lulu. What do you think here?
What do I think? Well, I think Lulu's got, I'd say, the most rational explanation.
I mean, Lulu's very rational, but everyone's buying in the, I'm telling you, they just needed to calm it down there.
I mean, yeah. You can't, you know, if the environment is in flux and being agitated by an influx of people that are not normally there. I'm sure there are people that go by the lagoon all the time, but it's not usually under the media firestorm that comprised the last few weeks.
Yeah, the media firestorm. People are just getting at me here on the text line, 847. Why be so negative, Mr. Cynical? This is not negative. This is curious. There's a word.
You remind me of Mark Ruffalo in Spotlight right now.
They knew, and they let it happen.
708. Unbelievable. You must have a smaller brain than the alligator. One day away from August, and you're still talking about a baby alligator in a lagoon, Dan and Marty. Never gotten a text from Dan and Marty. Is there a Dan and a Marty? Or those are two alligators? I'm a little confused. Regardless.
It's Mary.
Oh, Mary.
Dan and Mary.
Dan and Mary. Oh, hi, Dan and Mary. Listen, first of all, we're a couple of days away from August. And second of all, let's not insult that fine gator and his brilliant brain. I'd like to be as intelligent as that gator who found his way to gator heaven down there in Florida. All right. Thought Alligator Bob should have gotten more credit than they gave him. That's what I'm talking about, Gwen. I feel you out in Jefferson Park. Alligator Bob gave great effort. All right, we got a 15-second spot, and then the news coming here, and then we're going to switch the conversation to some competitive eating with a guy who's very heartfelt, too. Patrick Bertoletti will be with us after 1:30. I think you'll enjoy the conversation. 720 WGN. That's right, it's July 29th. That means it's National Chicken Wing Day. Buffalo Wild Wings is celebrating with the buy one, get one free wing. Purchase of any small, medium, or large order of boneless or traditional wings. Now our guy Joey Chestnut, who we talked to and might play some of that back tonight, Joey Chestnut is working with Hooters. He's got 12 hours to eat as many wings as possible. Now, we don't have the ability to talk to Joey tonight, but we have somebody who has competed against Joey and is Chicago's very own, and that is Patrick Deep Dish Bertoletti, who I spoke to very briefly last night in an impromptu fill-in. And Patrick, you were so interesting. I was talking to Mary Sandberg. And I said, I'd love to have a longer conversation with Patrick. And then all of a sudden, it's a day later, and we're doing this. So it's part two of the interview. So, Patrick, thanks for waking up, man. 1:36 in the morning. We appreciate you.
No problem. I've never been called interesting before. I'm sure my girlfriend will be really happy to hear that.
No one's...
She's never said so much.
Hold on, man. Like, I'm looking at a picture of you right now. You got a mohawk haircut. You got you look every bit of interesting. That I don't see anything about you that's uninteresting. That's unfair to you.
To be honest, when I got into competitive eating, I knew I was just like a schlubby white kid, and I knew I needed a gimmick. So it was right around the time Eater X, who is another competitive eater, he was doing like a face paint thing like Ultimate Warrior. So I just decided like I needed a gimmick, and so I just chose the mohawk, you know. So that was the thing.
Are you still rocking it right now or no?
I am not. Thankfully, I mean, that's such a lot of work, and I decided, I realized at like 26 that I had it for so long that my hair was receding, and that's like the perfect haircut to hide that, so I did not notice it until like 26, was losing my hair. I'm not really losing my hair, but just a little bit, you know.
Okay, fair enough. So, how did you get the interest to be, you know what? I want to be a competitive eater. I think I can make a name for myself.
Well, I always say when God was giving out talents, he just reached down deep in the bag and just kind of shrugged his shoulders and just threw this overeating and overconsumption at me. And I don't know, I just grew up the youngest of five, kind of struggling to find my way and find my voice and my talents. And before I really found cooking, I always knew that I had an above average appetite, and that was kind of what I clung to and what I prided myself on. And my twin sister realized this and knew I was good at it and suggested I enter my first contest probably 14 years ago, Bocce's Pizza in Chicago. She's like, hey, you should enter this. I think you'd do well. And I did. And I think I got third place, and then kind of the rest is history.
So you're one of five. You're the youngest. Did you say, did I hear that right?
Yeah.
And so you're kind of fighting for some attention in the family here. And you're like, you know what? If I do this, mom and dad and maybe my brothers and sisters will pay attention to me. Am I on the right track here?
I think so, yeah. I mean, at that point, they had kind of just, not that they had given up on us, but they were just so tired because that's a lot of kids in this day and age. And both my parents work, and they sent they worked a lot to send us to really good schools, and it was just more, I don't even know, so stupid that I would decide to do that, but I'm so grateful and so happy that I chose to let this overconsumption gene, like, take, you know, like, take precedent in my life for so long. It's taken me to so many great places that I really can't complain.
Yeah. What's, like, when you think about, like, your greatest moments, what comes to mind?
It's funny that you mentioned chicken wings, because I think the best event in my life that I won was a wing bowl in Philly where I set the record anymore, but I ate 444 chicken wings in 30 minutes, which was the record. I set a new record, and I won $10,000, a motorcycle, and a really ugly Super Bowl ring. So that was pretty cool.
Okay, you ate 444 chicken wings in 10 minutes. Did I hear that right?
30 minutes.
In 30 minutes. Okay.
Yeah.
And you got $10,000.
How? Yeah, and overpriced motorcycle and a Super Bowl ring that turned my finger green after wearing it one night.
How did you feel afterwards? How do you feel normally afterwards? It can't be great, right?
Well, it's just a lot of stress and strain on your body. But when you're talking about something like that, where I had competed in that event so many times, probably 5 times otherwise, and I got second every time to Joey Chestnut and another eater. It just was ecstatic and very draining, but it's also you're very satisfied at the same time. And I was never really competitive because I played sports growing up, but that wasn't really my thing. I was, to be honest, I was 180 pounds in 8th grade, like on the wrestling team, getting my ass beat by everyone, you know? So like, I wasn't the most athletic person, but I found my competitive edge and my voice in competitive eating, where I'm like, hey, I think I'm pretty good at this. And then I actually took it serious, and then I kind of figured out through training, through help with my friend Joe Chestnut, he's like, kind of let me know how to train and get better. And I don't know, it's very fun, interesting, and it's just challenge your body, and you know, it's a way to push yourself. And it was very I don't know, fulfilling for a long time.
So it sounds like people don't. I'm learning myself right now that this is something that is flat out not easy. You have to train. It's a skill, and you have a community of people that are doing it. And so there's really like a huge reward for you as far as, you know, recognition within the community. And plus, you know, you get a lot of attention too. It gets coverage.
Yeah, and it's kind of funny because a lot of the eaters, if you put a microphone in front of us, we're really not good on our feet, and we are not. We can talk. I mean, it's given me the chance to be a better public speaker, but we just give the most lousy interviews ever, you know. So we're kind of all introverts, but we secretly crave the attention, I suppose. And it's just something where you're driven, and you just want more, and I think it's just, we don't have the governors in our bodies to tell us when too much of anything is enough, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, training is a big part. You chug lots of water, you practice with the food, and it is like almost a full-time thing where you have to do it every day, and you have to, it really sucks for people not like Joey or Kogashi, where they don't have jobs per se. Like, for everyone else, I was working 9 to 5, actually a lot more than that, in restaurants, and then I'd have to go home after working all day and like think about training, eat like 50 hot dogs, go to the gym. It's like, it's a lot of effort put into it.
Patrick Deep Dish Bertoletti with us here on 720 WGN. You also, hold on, I got a bunch of questions going on here. How big are you right now?
I play the fifth because I am extremely over. For me, I'm 6'2", like 250 right now, which is the heaviest I've ever been. But I would say my fighting weight would be about 215 to 210.
Okay.
But I'm grossly overweight right now.
Okay. And you were 180 pounds, and how tall is an eighth grader?
I'd say about 5'10".
So you're 5'10", 180 as an eighth grader. That's what I basically weigh right now. I'm a little bit underneath that. But as an eighth grader, I went into my freshman year of high school as a 5 foot, 100 and some odd, maybe 105 pounds at most, prepubescent teenager. That's incredible. So that's, it's awkward being that big and that young, is it not? I would think.
I mean, it's always, yeah, it's not, it's constantly, I've been thinking about my weight for, I'm not going to go all like, I have an eating problem because I don't. I just really like food. So it's just like, I don't know, it's a constant struggle where I chose the worst profession ever. I'm a chef and I'm a competitive eater. So it's like, and I cook. So it's like, well, I'm cooking as well. So it's like, it's kind of like an alcoholic who owns a bar. It's like, what were you thinking, you know? But I love it so much. I guess that's the reason I'm somewhat good at what I do, you know, on both fronts.
Right. You own Taco in a Bag. Is that where you work?
Yeah, that's my restaurant. Yep.
Okay. And up on Lincoln? Is that where that's Taco in a Bag?
Yeah, it's like 4600 North Lincoln. Yeah. 4603 North.
Yeah,
Lincoln.
I know it well. I used to live in the Lincoln Square neighborhood, so I've had a delicious Taco in a Bag multiple times, Patrick. So thank you for your service. It's
well,
delicious.
You got it. Next time you come in, I'll fill up one of a. I kind of, not that I'm over talking about competitive eating, but like at some point, I stopped keeping all my trophies and all the ones I had left upon my last move. And the open of the restaurant, I just decided let's put them all into the bathroom, the restaurant. So yeah, you can come see all the old relics, like the 10 or 15 year old trophies from my past competitive eating exploits in the bathroom at the restaurant.
Well, your Wikipedia says that in January of 2007, you became the first person to complete the Sasquatch Burger Contest at Bigfoot Lodge in Memphis, Tennessee. Is this accurate?
Yes. Yes.
670 people tried to finish the burger and fries that starts with 4 pounds of hamburger meat on a homemade bun. Bertolotti finished the meal in 11 minutes and 5 seconds. You were the first one to do it.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun because I didn't go. I went in, I didn't tell anyone who I was, and nobody had ever done it before. And to this day, I'm pretty close friends with the owner, and he makes delicious food in Memphis, and I would highly recommend that place. I've since gone back. I think I Chestnut went in and broke my time, and then I went back, and I did it in like 7 minutes, and then the newer eater, Matt Stoney, came in and did it in like 5 minutes, so I'm due to go back and break that time. But that thing total weighs about 7 or 8 pounds, the whole challenge. It's a lot of food, but it's quite delicious.
I think it sounds amazing. I don't know if I could do it. And what would it take the normal person in your mind, Patrick, to eat that?
Well, it's like anything else, really. I think the only advantage I had going into it, just from a pure genetic standpoint, was I blame my dad for the genetics. Like, I don't really need to chew my food. I have an above average appetite. I love to eat and overeat and overconsume and. I don't really, like I said, I don't need to chew my food, so like I'll just a lot of not chewing and just, I was always a fast eater, so that's the hardest part to train somebody to do. It's a lot easier to train somebody to gain the capacity to hold the food and get it down. But I mean, I could train somebody. It just all depends if they really want to do it, which I would not highly recommend. It's the dumbest thing you could ever do yourself, but I'm not upset with my plot in life either. At the same time.
You know, is this true? You've got world records in 16-inch pizza, 47 slices in 10 minutes, blueberry pie, chicken wings, chocolate, corned beef and cabbage, corned beef sandwiches, date nut bread, donuts, cream-filled, grits, ice cream, jalapeno peppers, pickled multiple times, key lime pie, oysters, peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, love a good PB&J, shoe fly pie, strawberry rhubarb pie, strawberry shortcake, waffles, love a good waffle, whole turkey. Is this true? You have world records and all this stuff?
When you put it that way, yes. That all sounds quite familiar. I think I'm not in the league that puts on those events that sponsors them, so I think a few of those I don't have anymore, but with the ones I've lost, I have several at the Guinness Book. I think at least 15, but I don't really know off the top of my head. But I'm still somewhat relevant in the history books, I suppose.
If you were to rank yourself all time in the history of competitive eating, where do you fall?
top five for sure.
My top ranking.
I mean, I'm pretty self aware. I think Chesta's number one. You got to go Kobayashi, and then there's actually this eater Molly Schuyler, who is incredible. Who's beaten me? I've only beaten her in chicken wings. She's really good. I put her number three, and then I'm not sure. The face painter guy, Eater X, is quite incredible too. So I'd probably put him number four.
Is there any dating?
I'd say I'm top seven or eight. Now that I'm thinking, all these are good guys.
Seven, eight, five. Any of it is a great accomplishment, Patrick. Is there any dating that goes on in the competitive eating thing? Does that turn you on the female side?
Yeah. Well, I always say, they always ask if there's groupies with this, which was never my MO. I'm not even just saying that because I'm spoken for. I just really like to overconsume and eat a lot and drink a lot. So Chestnut did really well. If you ever ask Joey Chestnut a lot, he's not single as well. So I can't speak for him at this point, but he did better than he should have, considering his looks. And he'll tell you as such. He's like, he does a lot better than he should just because he's a winner. And I always say, though, you have to really suspect of a girl if she's interested in just because you can eat a lot, you know. It's kind of like the Groucho Marx quote, you know, I'm always suspicious of a club that will ever have me as a member. So
right, that's a classic line there. It's interesting though. Joey's doing better for himself. I mean, if I'm thinking about, if I'm a woman, if I may try to do this and thinking about dating Joey Chestnut, well, he's got a great appetite. He's an incredible competitor. He's a winner. Why wouldn't I want to meet Joey Chestnut? Something along those lines.
Yeah, that's what you would think, and that's me and him coming up together in like our early 20s. We're very enthusiastic. We'd be like, oh, we were on TV. Like, this will give us a step up with the females. But then you go out to bars after and you just find out it's just a total sausage fest and it's only dudes that are interested in buying you drinks. So it's not really, it's not as glamorous or as fruitful as you would think. Yeah. You know? It's like the meathead demographic is pretty, very staunch supporters of competitive eating.
Right. Not all that surprising. All right. Hey, Patrick, thanks for getting up, man. I appreciate you sharing.
No problem.
And, stay healthy out there and get yourself down to playing weight and go get some more titles and look forward to catching up with you down the line, man. I'll be paying attention.
Yeah, come visit me at the restaurant anytime, and I would love to feed you. I don't even need the publicity. I'm just glad that you think I'm interesting and you want to talk to me, and I'll talk to you anytime and whatever you need going forward.
I'll talk in the back. I'll see you there, my man. Appreciate you.
Yeah. No problem. Thank you.
All right, Patrick Bertoletti, competitive eater. This is my. I'm learning things here, Tom.
Yeah. I did not know about the competitive eating dating scene.
The competitive eating dating scene.
That's a world.
Joey Chestnut does better for himself than he should do.
I always feel bad when people say that. Even, you know, he's saying it about himself. I get it, but hey, man, you know.
You have some confidence.
Yeah, personality gets you. I mean, clearly he's confident enough to go on national television yearly and swallow more hot dogs than I've ever seen anybody swallow.
It's actually an interesting question for those late night listening. I mean, when you're sizing up, gentlemen, we all think it's about the look. I don't think women, like, looks are, I don't think that's the number one criteria. I don't even know if it's number two. It might be like six on the list. Personality, confidence.
Being funny will get you a long way.
Humor is huge.
If you're funny, you'll do way better than you probably should.
How about just being kind, being a gentleman?
Yeah.
I mean, maybe they say that, but then it doesn't really actually work out that way. I like the bad guys. You hear that all the time. Oh, and a bad guy. All right, let's take a quick time out. 720 WGN. Jesus just left Chicago. 720 WGN. Good morning, 156. Welcome to your Monday. Let's get after it this week. Last week of July, first week of August. All in one, if you will. From competitive eating, and thanks again to our guy Patrick Bertoletti for jumping on here on National Chicken Wing Day. Do you know who Russie Taylor is, Tom?
It doesn't ring a bell. I mean,
Russie Taylor is the voice, or was the voice, of Minnie Mouse.
Ah, okay. Yeah, I did see this.
Yeah. She's best known for voicing the Disney character Minnie Mouse since 1986. She passed away 75 years old. Minnie Mouse, quote, lost her voice with the passing of Russie Taylor. That's from Disney CEO Bob Iger.
Iger,
thank you very much. I should know that. Her voice reigned in hundreds of television shows, theme park rides, animated shorts, and films. Taylor is a native of Cambridge, Massachusetts. 1991, she married Wayne Allwine, who had voiced Mickey Mouse since 1977.
Wait, hold up. Minnie Mouse and Mickey Mouse were married in real life.
Yes, this is why I brought it up. She married Mickey Mouse. Minnie and Mickey. Do people know this? She was also provided the voice of Martin Prince and the twins, Sherry and Terry, on more than 100 episodes of The Simpsons and The Simpsons Movie. And she voiced Pebbles Flintstone. She was Pebbles. Aw. And Huey, Dewey, and Louie in DuckTales.
Wow. Wow.
See, it almost ruins it for me that there was a one person who was all these iconic cartoon characters.
Oh, then I would not suggest digging much deeper, because you're going to find out how many, like, single people voiced a very wide range of characters. If you look into the world of voice acting, a lot of people who are super successful voice a lot of different characters.
Really?
Yeah.
You want to take me down a really deep, dark hole and ruin it for me right now?
Oh, man.
We're here till 5, so we can figure that out. But the fact that she married Wayne Allwine, who had voiced Mickey Mouse, Mickey and Minnie were married. R.I.P. to Russie Taylor. I don't remember Minnie Mouse a ton. I mean, Mickey Mouse, full legend. Legend enough to be able to create Minnie Mouse. Do you remember Minnie Mouse? Minnie Mouse?
Well, I mean, I haven't exactly been watching Disney Channel in like 10, 15 years.
You haven't, Tom? Come on, man. You're a movie guy.
But I, you know, I remember the voice of Minnie Mouse, just like I remember the voice of Mickey Mouse or any of the, you know, Goofy, all of them. Yeah. I mean, I grew up with that.
Yeah.
That was her voice. She gave that to us.
She did. Getting text here. Don't look into Mel Brooks then. What did Mel Brooks do? How many people did Mel Brooks live the dream with? All right. At any rate, Minnie Mouse has passed away, or at least the latest Minnie Mouse, Russie Taylor. Good morning, 205. Mark Harmon in for Nick DiGilio tonight. Nick D under the weather. Hopefully we'll be back later. Well, that'd be tomorrow, actually. Right, that's how that works. I get it. It's very confusing, the overnight and what time it is and where I am. And how long have you been doing it now, Tom?
I'm probably pushing about 4 months now.
4 months. Do you feel upside down still, or is it the body all rolling? This feels normal.
I feel upside down regardless, Mark, but I've adjusted.
Okay.
I've adjusted to this life, and I quite enjoy it.
Aw, look at you. Just seizing an opportunity and feeling good about it.
Hey, man, I'm 25 years old. I can handle it.
25 years old. Do you realize what position you're in, Tom Hush?
I do. It is not lost on me.
Okay, good. Because if I could go back and do the last 20 years of my life again, I would just change a couple things, you know, overall.
Yeah.
Maybe live and learn. These you can't. You don't get to play it twice.
No.
But at any rate, cherish the youth of a 25-year-old. It's awesome. Okay. Minnie Mouse, the voice, passed away. And this takes us into a very interesting topic that everybody should be able to weigh in on here. Phone lines are going to be open, as they always are. 312-981-7200. So, this is about whether an adult can go to a Disney park without a kid. Are us, as adults, do we need to have a child, our own child, nephew, niece, distant cousin, family friend? Do you need to have somebody in tow that's, say, 10 or under with you to be able to go to Disney World or Disneyland, Disney in general? So this is the story from USA Today. Going to a Disney theme park without any kids, is it weird or is it just fun? We've got a debate on who should be visiting a park based on, of course, the children's movies. This was sparked after a Twitter user, at Jen Cat writes, she shared a screenshot of an expletive-ridden Facebook post from a mom who was calling on the park to ban guests without children. The mom was irate, and she complained that adults in attendance made lines unnecessarily long and frustrating for her own child. Quote, Disney World is a family amusement park, with 4 exclamation points. Yet these immaturer, she added an R on immature, these things happen, millennials throw away in bold their money on useless crap, with 4 exclamation points. They have no, bold letters, idea, the joy, bold letters, and happiness, bold letters, it is to mother who buys their babies treats and toys. They will never experience the exhaustion that it is to chase a 3-year-old around and getting stares at assuming I'm a bad mother. So now we're getting to the root of this. She sees all these millennials that she's called millennials having a great time, walking around. Maybe they're, whatever, playing some of the carnival games, riding rides, laughing. And she's having a miserable time chasing her 3-year-old. And the lines are long, the kids are impatient, and now she's blaming her experience on the millennial. And this doesn't seem right to me, Tom. Why can't a millennial go to Disney World or even Six Flags? Six Flags Great America. Let's bring it local here.
Sure.
Now, I was never the summer pass guy in high school, but I would go once a year back in the day. Now, once I got over, say, I don't know, let's say, just go college years. I think I've been like twice in the last 20-plus years. But if I want to go to Six Flags and live the dream and ride Batman or whatever the new ride is, shouldn't I be allowed to do that without having a kid with me?
Yeah, I think it's funny that the anger is focused on millennials. Because I know that there are plenty of older folks out there that love going to Disney World, or they love going to Six Flags, or just parks in general like that.
I'm just curious if there's any older people right now that still go to Disney World, Disneyland, Six Flags, whatever amusement park you choose by yourself, or say, I don't know, with a friend.
Mm-hmm.
And just like to, you know, enjoy yourself. 312-981-7200. But here's a bigger thing from the tweet. It would be great if we as adults would start to own our own experience. You're going to Disney World. You should know going there that there are going to be lines, that your kid is going to be a little bit out of control, that most likely there's probably going to be a crying fit at some point, that they're going to be hungry and the line's going to be long and you're going to buy them the chicken fingers and they're not going to like it and they're going to want the grilled cheese and you're either going to have to draw the line. This is what I bought you. This is what you're eating. I don't care if you're crying. Things cost money. You wanted the chicken fingers. That's what you're going to have. Or whatever. Go back in line and get them the grilled cheese if you want to be that parent. I don't. But it's, we all, it's, I just see this more and more now. We want to blame everyone else. You're going, you got to have a little bit of an anticipation of what's going to happen. What did you think? You're going to go to Disney World and no one was going to be there? And yes, people are going to look at you and think you're a bad mom. That's their judgment. It let them think whatever they want to think. It's about them. It's not about you. You don't have to take that on. I know this is not easy, by the way. But just a little public service announcement from Matt the Car Mirror. This is, don't let some bozo at the amusement park who's looking at you because your three-year-old's crying, and now all of a sudden you're starting to feel like you're a bad mom. You know why you feel like you're a bad mom? Because you're obviously judging yourself, and you're thinking about ways in which you could do better that you're not doing, and now you want to put it on that dude, Tom Hush, who's at the amusement park, and he's looking at you like you're crazy.
Whoa, hey.
I mean,
I am one of three boys.
Yeah?
God bless my mother for dealing with that. I know there are plenty of families that are bigger, have many more kids, but we were not exactly super well-behaved. And she was a saint for putting up with me. So whenever I see a mom or a dad or anybody going through a tough time in public, I just say a little prayer for them, man, because you don't know what that kid's going through. You don't know what that parent is going through.
Right.
I'm always very, like, hands-off, like, hey, man, I know what's up.
That's what I'm saying. Like, well, which is what I said a second ago. Anybody's judgment on your parenting, that's about them. Tom, you, good old Tom, you're sitting back, hey, man, I'm not going to be that person judging because I know what a pain in the ass I was.
Honestly, I would say most people, if we're talking people my age, probably just don't care. They're just like, whatever.
I don't know. If I'm at a park and there's a crying kid, I'm gonna look at you. But then it's about me. It's got nothing to do with you. It's not your fault. Don't let that ruin your experience. Hey, Vince. Welcome to 720.
Hey, Mark.
What's up, man?
How you doing? Same old, brother.
You're Vince, it says here you're in your 60s and you go to Disney World. Is that right?
Four times a year.
What do you have it scheduled at the beginning on the Vince calendar?
Pretty much.
Why do you go?
No, when I get vacations from work, I go down there four times a year.
You go to Epcot Center in Orlando four times a year.
Epcot, Magic Kingdom, Hollywood Studios. We do it all four times a year.
Do you take children with you?
Once in a while, we'll take my grandson.
Do you do any other trips, Vince? This is fascinating.
Well, they live in Florida.
Okay.
Okay, so we go down to Florida to visit them, but we get away and we go to Disney World. We'll go to Universal.
So you got family in Florida, you fly down, you take a little Florida vacay, and part of that deal is you go to Disney World every time. Kids love it, you love it, the whole thing.
Exactly.
What's your favorite thing to do there?
The World Showcase over at Epcot.
Vince, you don't sound very enthusiastic about this right now.
Well, it's 2 o'clock in the morning, I'm on my way from work.
Okay.
I mean, come on. But I'm trying to get focused on the day. It ain't gonna work.
what do you do, Vince?
I'm a garbage man.
What's your shift? From when to when?
4 o'clock in the morning till whenever we get off. Normally it's about 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
Do you know my man Howard Cadet? Does that name ring a bell?
No, it does not. It depends on what company he works for.
Well, he's a city worker.
Okay, no, I do not know him.
Okay. Vince, you're doing God's work out there. You know that, right?
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, you do not get enough appreciation, flat out. I hope you're getting. I know you guys get paid pretty well, but I still think I double your salary, Vince. Just so you know, not that I have the power to do these things, but you know, if I could, I would.
Oh, trust me, we'd all appreciate it. You know, it's funny. I was talking to one of my brothers that worked in the same industry as I do in Florida, and the pay scale is totally different than what we make up here.
Uh-huh.
It's cut in half.
Really?
We do the same work.
Why do you think that is? You want to go deep, dark dive here? I'm interested.
Florida is a right-to-work state.
Okay. All right.
I'm union. Florida's the right to work state, and and people doing the same job that we do up here, they're only making $18-$20 an hour.
So hold on a second here, Vince. You're not a wealthy guy, but you do all right for yourself, and you choose to spend your disposable income going to Disney World four times a year. That's significant love right there, Vince, as we make this thing come full circle.
Oh, absolutely. We have no bills. All our bills are paid off. My house is paid off.
Congrats. Good job.
Thank you. So, you know, my cars are in good shape. I got extra money. You know, I got money stacked away in the bank. So whenever I could go down to Florida, I'll go down to Florida.
I'll see you at Magic Mountain, Vince.
Magic Kingdom? Okay, sounds good. When do you want to go?
Magic Kingdom, my bad. Is there not a Magic Mountain?
There's Six Flags Magic Mountain.
What's the ride at Epcot where it's you can't see where you're going to go? That's not Magic Mountain? Am I nuts here?
Talking about Space Mountain?
Space Mountain. Space Mountain.
Space Mountain, yeah.
My bad. Okay, fine. Magic Kingdom, Space Mountain. It's been a minute.
Yeah, it's all right. That's a fantasy land, yeah. It's okay.
Vince, thanks for calling, man. Have a great Monday.
You too. Take care, Carm. Talk to you soon.
Appreciate it. 312-981-7200. I've been to Epcot one time. I was in eighth grade. My mom, little sidetrack here, my mom had just passed away. My dad wanted to take me on a nice trip. So we're going down to Epcot. We go to the airport. We gotta, you know, I think we're flying like, back then it was, there was, what was that East Coast airline? Anyway, it doesn't matter. We get on the flight. They're like, hey, sorry, we got the seats back here in coach. We don't have them for you. Why don't we put you in first class? We get bumped up to first class. We fly down to Epcot. They're like, yeah, this room that you guys booked, we don't have that one. Give me the upgrade. You're on the special floor. We had access to like the sweet like breakfast every single day, and somehow we got like tickets to like we were like first in line. The whole thing, the whole trip, we just kept on getting handed things. I was like, I don't know how this is happening. But this is an amazing experience. But that's the one time I've ever been to Epcot, man.
Yeah.
Eighth grade. Maybe I need to be an adult. Go back.
Yeah, check it out.
All right. Hey, Brian, welcome to WGN. Hey, what's going on, man?
Hey, what are you doing, young man? Good to see you. Good to hear you, anyways. Yeah, you know, I was married, had three kids with my wife, and we drove down to, you know, Florida to go to Disney World, and it was a fun trip. Until we got to Disney World. And, I mean, the kids, they're just really super, you know, energied up. And they just want to, you know, oh, we got to do this, got to do that, got to do this, got to do this, you know. And I'm like, wait, you know, one thing at a time. You know, my wife, she's trying to calm them down. And, you know, but, I mean, the kids, you know, being kids, they're going to do what they want. But I mean, it was a great time. But I'll tell you what, it was expensive. Was not cheap. We stayed down there and took us a couple days to get through it, and with the kids because they kept wanting. And the crazy thing about it was, the kids are sitting in the hotel room at night, and they're still up. They're so wired, and they're watching ads for Universal. They want to go to Universal now. Instead of driving back home, they want to drive over to Universal and and do that trip. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And, hey, Brian, slow down.
Yeah. Huh?
Do you want to go to an amusement park as an adult without kids?
Well, yeah, I probably should do that. I haven't done that. I used to go to Riverview when I was a boy.
Aww.
And, but I was going to Lane Tech, right?
Yeah.
And, because it was right next door. So I knew some of the boys in school, you know, and they check your pass. You know, you had to have a hall pass to walk through the halls when classes were going on, right?
Hey, Brian, and, how old are you?
67.
You're 67? You went to Riverview?
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
I don't know if that adds up.
Yeah, it does.
All right, Brian, I'm going to put you on hold. I got some weird echo going on here. Thank you for the call. I don't know what was going on there, but do you know what Riverview is? Riverview is where my father went to. That was like the roller. That was the amusement park in the city.
Yeah,
but 67.
I think that checks out.
Does that check out? I thought that Riverview like was done in the 50s. Am I wrong about that?
It's operated from 1904 to 1967.
To 67. All right.
So if he's my dad,
he's 67. It's 2019 here, so 19 plus 33 there, that's 50. That checks out. All right. Okay, fine. He was like 14 years old going to Riverview. Mm-hmm. Fair enough. Didn't mean to do the math on you there, but just want to make sure we get an accurate reporting here on 720 WGN.
Where's the trust, man?
I need to trust the listener more. Need to trust the listener. You went to Riverview. I don't need to do the math on you. Thank you for the lesson. Quick time out. 720 WGN. In the sweet summertime. 720 WGN. A lot of support on the text line for adults going to Disney World. Yes, you can really enjoy Disney World from the 630 as adults without children. My husband and I went in our 60s. Granted, our son came with us, but he was in his 40s. There are many things that appeal to adults traveling without little ones. Okay. And now people texting in about Riverview. My dad is 72 and he went to Riverview. Mm-hmm. Okay. 224. My 50-year-old friend goes to Cedar Point every year for the last 30 years. He's single. Cedar Point. What's Cedar Point?
That's Ohio, I want to say.
Okay.
Yeah, that's on, I want to say Lake Erie.
Okay.
And I know if that's wrong, I'll probably get chewed out. But that's an intense roller coaster park. Some good stuff.
Can we go go-karting? Is that legal? Yeah? Okay. I'm trying to think. Things that adults don't do that we should do. Go-karting. Six Flags Great America. I think adults should go to the park and ride on the swing. Get out there. Why do you got to be 4 years old to be on the swing? Wouldn't it be good to see a 62-year-old, 80-year-old just having a summer day, getting a little swing, a little wee, have some little relive of the childhood? Am I losing my mind right now? I don't know. These things like, it's important. Message from Matt the Carm here. Yours truly, Mark Carmen. It's important to not lose your child. You can still be a kid even when you're getting to your full adult, even late adult years. Don't lose the childhood enthusiasm. When's the last time you went on the swing, Tom?
Oh,
you would, you 25-year-old adult you?
Probably not since I was a camp counselor in college.
See? Wouldn't you like to go out for a swing right now?
I'd love to go out for a swing.
Right?
I went, I love riding bikes.
Ride a bike.
Just for fun. Not because you're trying to get anywhere. Just for fun, I went to Mackinac Island in Michigan, you know, and you could ride a bike around the entire island.
Yeah.
And I felt like I was 8 years old again. It was so weird.
It's funny that you say that because I'm right after this show, I'm getting in the car and I'm driving not to Mackinac Island, but to Boyne Mountain, which is in the UP, which is an hour from Mackinac Island. We did this trip last year, me and the fiance, and we went to Mackinac. I thought that Mackinac was I loved the island.
Sure.
And then the ferry ride over was sweet.
Yeah.
But there's this, the Grand Hotel. Did you go to the...
We didn't go in it. We saw it.
Okay. So they charge you to just go in the hotel.
Yeah. So that's why we didn't go in.
Right. Right. Which was a decent decision. But I go to the Grand Hotel. And I felt like I was in... It was like The Shining in there, man.
Oh, a little bit, yeah.
I
can imagine.
Not The Shining. That's not even accurate. It was more like Get Out. That's what I felt like. these people that were working there,
they looked like they were trapped.
They were trapped, and it felt super uncomfortable. Can I help you with something? Have they drugged you? What's going on here? Why are you working on the Grand? Why are you working at the Grand Hotel? Very nice hotel. You want to get a Coca-Cola at the Grand Hotel? They'll give you a little bottle on the front deck there for like $8. you know, like this, like a, I don't know, 6 ounce Coca-Cola. But it's, you know, you're sitting at the Grand Hotel. It's beautiful. But the people working there, I was just like, you need to leave. This is not for you. Please go do something else with your life. Hey, how a shortage of specialized workers has turned summer construction season into an even bigger mess than usual. That is tonight's cover story on WGN TV News at 9. It is 2:30, so we're going to have to get a check of news, which, don't worry, Vic Vaughn, I see you running in there. You take your time, chill out, relax, we're all good. Get yourself settled, and yes, coming up after 2:30, well, there. This is an interesting text. You're an idiot for hanging up on that gentleman for reminiscing. Hey, I didn't hang up on anybody. There was an echo on the phone. I let him talk for a while. I love a good reminisce. You want to call up and reminisce? 773, reminisce away. Every text gets read on the overnight when I'm doing it. So if you
clearly
want, yes, that's what I do. Coming up at 3 o'clock, going to play a conversation I had with former White Sox manager, longtime player for the White Sox as well, Ozzie Guillen. Ozzie shares a lot of beautiful stuff on his journey from a 140-pound guy coming out of Venezuela who never thought he'd play in the big leagues to managing and to wanting to get back into the game. One thing I wanted to bring up this morning, and good morning, by the way, 2:36, welcome to your Monday. Mark Carmen in for Nick DiGilio. Nick D under the weather. He'll be back hopefully tomorrow night. So this comes out of the world of boxing. Two boxers in 1 week passing away. Argentine boxer Hugo Centillon died on Saturday night. He was in a fight with Uruguayan champion Eduardo Abreu. And then Russian boxer Maxim Dadashev died on Tuesday. He had emergency brain surgery for a subdural hematoma in his bout. So the World Boxing Council, with a statement saying, "We've received the very, very sad news, the death of the 23-year-old fighter Hugo, which happened today. He passes away in San Felipe Hospital in Buenos Aires." So, look, boxing is one of the great sports in the history, you know, that maybe the most intense sport of all time. It doesn't have the prominence that it had back in the day. We don't have Muhammad Ali. We don't have Joe Frazier. You know, whatever. Mike Tyson's been gone for a long time. And now the UFC and MMA has come up, and you see all these really incredibly violent octagon matches where there's blood all over the ring and people's faces are blown up and they're on the ground and they're wrestling and it looks super uncomfortable and people are getting their arms broke. Submit or I'm going to snap it. No, I'm not. Never. And then they snap the arm and it's just extremely violent. But UFC MMA, mixed martial arts, no one has ever passed away. They get beat up, they get knocked out, but they don't wear the gloves like they wear in boxing. Boxing, you have these huge gloves, right, to protect your hands. So the thing is, when you have that level of protection, you can fire away, man. And in essence, you can kill someone. And you would think that at some point, the boxing world, as much as they want to compete with UFC and MMA and be, you know, then maybe that's their calling card, you can get knocked out. But they're putting their fighters in danger to where they can die, and they do die. Two of them this week. Centillon passed out after the fight as the judges were announcing the decision. Okay, he fought till the end of the fight. He's sitting there in the corner, and then he passes out. He goes to the hospital. He was admitted with successive kidney failure. Then his brain was swelling. which ended up affecting the rest of his organs. He never regains consciousness. He undergoes surgery for a clot in his brain, went into cardiorespiratory failure twice before passing away from cardiac arrest. Quote, the World Boxing Council and its president, Mauricio Sulaiman Saldivar, send Hugo's family and friends their deepest condolences at this time of deepest grief. Look, a boxer knows when he's getting in the ring that this is something that could happen. But I'm just trying to protect these guys a little bit here. Just thinking about it. They're in most cases, boxing guys that go into boxing, they're coming from absolutely nothing. They're looking to somehow, some way, make their way in the world. And here you're creating an environment where people will spend big dough on pay-per-view or even to go to the ring nowadays to watch people with the possibility that, you know, somebody just might die. And we're gonna equip them with huge armor in the gloves so they don't have to worry about breaking their hand, throwing a punch. And if I smack you in the head multiple times as hard as I possibly can, I can just reload and do it again because I'm just that protected. Now, does that make any sense other than I'm just trying to make a big dollar, and not care one iota about the fighters? Muhammad Ali, one of the greatest heroes in the history of this country, right? I know that when he was in his prime, he wasn't as beloved as he was in his later years. But is there any doubt that the Parkinson's that he ended up taking on, and when he became beloved because he wasn't the same outspoken guy that he once was when he was diminished, that came from being in the ring? And again, you know, everybody knows what they're signing up for in life, but there's a way that they can make this a whole lot safer, and the sport would, I don't think it would lose popularity because the gloves were a little bit smaller and you couldn't actually kill someone in the ring. Again, you don't see that in UFC. You see a ton of violence, you see huge crowds, but they don't wear that level of glove. If you smoke someone in the face as hard as they do in boxing, they'll break their hand. It's a lot more skill.
Well, it's kind of the same thing with the difference between football and rugby.
Right.
Where in American football, you're wearing pads. I played American football for many years. And then I played rugby. Now, rugby's got its own problems, mainly spinal injuries. Those are way more common, but that's because of the way the game is played. But in terms of concussion rates and overall injury, you're more likely to get injured playing football than you are playing rugby.
No question. Which is, you know, they go back and forth on how to make the game safe. How to make the game safe? Get rid of the helmet, man. That thing is a weapon.
Mm-hmm. Because then you learn how to tackle with your body. You don't have that false sense of safety. And you're still going to get hurt. It's going to happen.
Right.
You're playing a contact sport. It's going to happen.
Yeah, but you're going to break bones. You're going to get hurt. But you're not going to get concussed to the level that you will with the helmet. But we love the violence. It makes us want to tune in. And doesn't it feel just a little bit gross, a little bit off? 312-981-7200 is the phone number. There was a piece in The Guardian written by Brian Armin Graham. Quote, there are no easy answers for the tragedies that have rocked professional boxing over the past week. The Argentinian junior welterweight Hugo Alfredo Santillan died Thursday from injuries suffered during his fight, becoming the second fatality in 4 days. Russia's Maxim Dadashev succumbed to injuries suffered last Friday. The double horror, a chilling reminder of the danger at hand anytime a fighter climbs through the ropes into a squared circle. The only venue in society, with the exception of war, where a person can be killed but not legally murdered. Think about that. It's a hell of a paragraph right there. It's also prompted renewed calls from at least one British charity for the sport to be permanently banned. Permanently banned. While the head trauma inherent to other sports such as American football, as Tom, you're just mentioning, rugby, ice hockey, has come increasingly under the microscope in recent years, only in boxing are dangers such as concussions, not by products, but the very objective. You are going in the ring and you are trying to knock the guy out. You want to knock him unconscious. And boxing is not as popular as it once was, but if you had somebody come along who was a Mike Tyson type or just a personality anywhere close to the Muhammad Ali's or whatever, the sport would get a ton of attention. Spectre and Def has loomed over the prize ring throughout history from its recorded origins, as a popular spectator sport in ancient Greece and Rome. I mean, if you've been to the Colosseum, I mean, this is medieval stuff, what we're watching. And, you know, I remember stories as a kid, my parents watching boxing, they're screaming at the television, stop the fight, stop the fight, stop the fight, stop the fight, dude's dead. Didn't stop the fight. So, anyway, just wanted to get that out there. And death in the ring, for the record, is statistically rare, but there's, again, as he writes here, there's no question boxing is the most dangerous pastime, despite a perception as the tamer alternative to the often grisly spectacle of mixed martial arts and the head-to-toe violence it purveys to a generally younger demographic. MMA fighters wear smaller 4-ounce gloves. They're less conducive to defense and more prone to causing cuts, though what many do not realize is the extra padding on those boxing gloves exists not to protect the face but the fist, allowing fighters to throw punches with full force. So people shouldn't be dying in the boxing ring right now. That stuff just should not be happening at all. Take a quick timeout, 720. No. We're working on... I'm sorry. Okay. Engineer Dan Long is in here messing with the computer in ways that only Dan Long knows how to do. Very talented man. Now we can take a quick timeout. All right, quick timeout, 720 WGN. Good morning, 249. Happy Monday. Mark Harmon in for Nick DiGilio, Tom Hush producing. Vic Vaughn's got your news. Talking boxing for a second here, and to do a complete left turn. Have you heard of the border collie named Chaser?
I can't say I have.
All right. Well, Chaser has been described as the world's smartest dog. There is no dog smarter than Chaser. He made headlines for being able to identify objects by their names. Now, Chaser has passed away. He's gone to doggy heaven, so he's going to be missed. But John W. Pilley, professor emeritus of psychology at Wofford College, he taught his border collie, who lived to be 15 years old, to understand more than 1,000 nouns. 1,000. I don't even know if I understand 1,000 nouns. He was conducting his own experiment, teaching dogs the name of objects, was inspired by the border collie farmers to rethink his methods. Excuse me. So he was given a black and white border collie, which turned into a guy by the name of Chaser. So he gets this dog, and for 3 years, Dr. Pilley trained the dog, Chaser, 4 to 5 hours a day. He would show her an object, said its name 40 times, and then he would hide the object, and he would ask her to find it. So, frisbee, 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 frisbee. Then he'd hide it under the thing, go find frisbee. And Chaser would do it. He used 800 cloth animal toys, 116 balls, 26 frisbees, and an assortment of plastic items to ultimately teach Chaser 1,022 nouns. Now, I know there's people out there right now that have dogs that you want to say are just as smart as Chaser. So if you have a brilliant dog, feel free. 312-981-7200. What can your dog do that other dogs can't do? You got a dog over there, Tom?
No, I do not. I'm not a dog person.
Okay.
Dogs don't like me. They don't like me.
Really?
Much.
Dogs attack you?
Not attack, but they. You know how they can say a dog can smell like fear or discomfort?
Yeah.
I didn't grow up with animals. My parents were both allergic to animals.
Uh-huh.
Not that we... I have no particular hatred or dislike towards animals. I just... I'm not used to being around them, so dogs get up in my face. Their breath is kind of bad. Like, they slobber, you know? So, it's just not really my bag. But, you know, more power to Chaser. But you called shenanigans on the Gator earlier.
Yeah?
I'm going to call shenanigans on this.
You're calling shenanigans on Chaser?
And no disrespect to Chaser. I'm sure he was a good boy. I'm sure he was a very good boy. But this reminds me of an actual historical event. Do you know the story of Clever Hans?
I do not.
Clever Hans was a horse.
Okay.
That allegedly could do arithmetic.
All right.
His owner, psychologist Oscar Fungst, believed he demonstrated that Clever Hans, this horse, could do math. Like, he'd, you know, write two numbers, do basic arithmetic.
Uh-huh.
But, and he would travel around with this horse, Clever Hans, and he would show people, oh my God, this horse can do arithmetic. He could do, you know, 4 + 5 or whatever, you know. But what they found out was that Hans was not actually doing arithmetic. He was just reacting to the body language and the involuntary cues of his human trainer. So the way he would do arithmetic is Oscar would basically say, all right, Hans, you know, 5 + 4 is what? And Hans would just...
7.
He would clap, you know, he would trot it out with his hoof.
He'd do the 9.
He'd do, yeah. But he would just keep going until Oscar's face seemed satisfied. So what... It's amazing because, one, this horse could see involuntary cues in people and could understand that. But Clever Hans could not actually do math. So I posit that Chaser, as good a boy as he was, may have just been reacting to certain cues in his owner in terms of going to get things. He didn't understand. There was no, I don't know how much cognition there was, but I think that it has to do with the observer expectancy effect.
See, I can't believe, this is interesting. I'm very disappointed here that you're attacking one of the great dogs of all time in Chaser, who gave a tremendous effort for his 15 years, who passed away at 15. Tom Hush is taking Chaser to town.
I don't think it's Chaser's. I think the owner, perhaps, has. It's the observer expectancy effect. They expect to see something.
In 2013, Dr. Pilley published his findings, explaining that Chaser was taught to understand sentences containing a prepositional object, verb, and direct object. Hold on here. Another daughter, Pilley Bianchi, said on Saturday that Chaser had been in declining health in recent weeks. The vet really determined that she died of natural causes. She went down very quickly. Ms. Bianchi, who helped her father train Chaser, maybe this will change your opinion, Tom, said the dog had been undergoing acupuncture for arthritis, da-da-da-da. But here's what we get to. What we would really like people to understand about Chaser is that she is not unique. It's the way she was taught that is unique. We believe that my father tapped into something that was very simple. He taught Chaser a concept, which he believed worked infinitely greater than learning 100 behaviors, and that her language learning is a very high-level power science. If Chaser had 30 balls, according to Bianchi, she'd be able to understand each one by its proper noun name and also as part of a group of objects. Quote, she learned the theory of one to many and many to one, which is learning one object could have many names and many names can apply To one object or one person. All right, forget this. I'm with you, Hush.
Yeah, right?
There's no way that what the... I don't even know what you're talking about. She learned the theory of one to many and many to one. I'm with you. I'm folding on Chase.
It's Clever Hans all over again.
This is a little bit over the top.
This is not to say that dogs are not remarkably intelligent.
No.
This is to say, like, we keep trying to put, like, human expectations on animals. Their cognition is wildly different than ours.
Why do you think we want our dog, you don't have a dog, but people want their dog to be super smart? It's a pride in ownership. He's so smart. She's so smart. What a smart doggy. It matters to us that our dog is smart. How ridiculous is that? But I hear it all the time. I mean, we're taking care of Luna the dog, my brother's dog, and we want the dog to be smart. I'm sitting in there in the elevator with the dog. I'm saying, jump up, Luna, jump up, jump up, jump up. Dog sits on the ground, just sits there and stares at me. Jump up, sits. Okay, you know what? Maybe you're not that smart. Maybe you got some good intuition going on here and there. But I mean, how smart can Luna the dog be when she hears thunder and she thinks the world's going to end? 4th of July, she's... Well,
that's not fair. Sometimes I hear thunder. I'm like, I don't like
now,
that.
No, come on, man.
I also run and hide under the couch.
You and Luna the dog. Luna the dog. Jump up, jump up, jump. Sits down. Is it really that hard to... But we do, right? We want our dogs to be brilliant. Carl, you saw Chaser on TV?
Yeah, I saw Chaser.
What do you think?
You know what? It was a real deal. It was the real deal. And they had this giant box full of toys, different colored toys and with different shapes and everything.
Uh-huh.
And this guy would say, go get the teddy bear, or go get the this, or go get the that. And the dog would run around behind this partition and rifle through this box of, I mean, there were hundreds of stuff. It would just pile all over the place. And rummage through it and come back with the correct thing. And it was a real deal. And the only analogy that I could draw between what the dog was doing is, you take dogs, now border collies are smart. If you ever saw them herding sheep, what they can do with sheep is unbelievable. But the interesting thing is, when you give a dog a tracking dog a brand new scent that had never smelled before, never, and you have them smell whatever it is, an article of clothing or something like that, and then you tell it, go track down this scent and find if it's a lost child or whatever you're looking for. These dogs' brains are so finely tuned to minuscule scents, smells that they can smell. I could picture them also using that some kind of the same circuitry to identify objects if you train them properly. And if you train them, it had to be tedious training, long-term tedious training to do this. But like I say, I actually saw it, and the owner was not signaling or nothing like that was going on. The dog was actually rummaging through piles and piles of stuff, and it would finally come up with the thing and come back with it. And people were just stunned when they saw it.
Carl, let me put you on hold. We're going to wear an echo. Carl, great call. And you seem the most informed on this subject. And I am back on board.
Okay.
He rummaged through a bin of stuffed animals and picked out the teddy bear. You got to give Chaser his due, Hush. Come on now.
This is flip-flopping on your part.
100%.
100%.
100%.
It's unfortunate that Chaser is no longer with us because I would be very curious to see someone stand it up to this Clever Hans thing, because I'm not kidding. This is like my girlfriend is getting a PhD in psychology, and not even like animal psychology, like children. Nothing to do with anything she's studying, and she still learned about Clever Hans because it's really important. So maybe I'm just being a grouch. Maybe I'm a Scrooge because a Chaser. But I don't know. I'm still going to call shenanigans. I'm using my shenanigans for the night, for the morning on this one.
Fair enough. And feel free to weigh in here if our dog's smarter than Hush is giving credit for here, as he's just dogging Chaser. No pun intended. 405 texting in, my dog isn't bright, but she is lovable. He is lovable. Excuse me. sweet that is. And that is the most important thing. I agree.
That is great.
That's right. That's the thing about
that. I like that.
You want to come home. You want somebody to be happy to see you. And somehow, some way, the dog always is. It's amazing. You walk in 2 in the morning, happy to see you. Walk in the afternoon, happy to see you. It's a beautiful thing. 720 WGN, good morning. 307, Mark Harmon with you, in for Nick D, who's under the weather tonight. Hopefully he'll be back tomorrow evening. So one of my favorite people to ever play and manage or coach in this city is Ozzie Guillen. Ozzie Guillen is one of the most, or one of the more unique people you'll ever come across. Speaks his mind, a people person, tons of friends, and is not afraid to say things that just others wouldn't say. It makes him more fun to be around, especially, you know, for somebody in my neck of the woods who cover a lot of games, and you get the same standard answers from coaches who are always trying to protect their players, the organization, not say anything that will ever create news. Ozzie's just not that way, and it's hurt him on some level because he's not in baseball right now, but it's also helped him in that he was able to win a World Series, and also, you know, he's on TV and he's done exceedingly well for himself. But let's bring in the conversation with Ozzie, and I started out asking him, like, how does a 140-pound guy who's getting drafted, how does that guy somehow make his way out of Venezuela into the MLB draft, and then somehow at that weight, competing against the best in the world, somehow make it all the way to the big leagues?
I never thought I was going to be a big league guy. You know, I just went out and play, and I just want to get out of my country and be somebody. And I've, you know, my education and what the education people hope to. And, you know, I mean, God gave me the opportunity to come to the United States. And, you know, back then it was harder. Back then it was very hard to play in the United States. Right now, I think it's easier. In the past, it was one scout for 30 kids. Nowadays, it's 30 scouts for one kid. And that's the way, you know, before they give you, you want to sign, they give you thank you, and you was pretty shit. Now they give you millions and millions of dollars to come back, to come here and play. But, you know, I got lucky to stay healthy. I got lucky my first year in Pro Bowl, played pretty well. My second year, lead the league in hitting and stuff. But I think I started clear about the game for real was in the Double-A, Triple-A when I got married. And my first child born in Triple-A, then, you know, I had responsibility. And then I started being more into the game and more responsibility. You know, I have more responsibility in my life for the game.
How old were you when you got married?
I was married. Let me ask my wife. How old were you married? 19.
19.
19 years old.
You felt ready, huh? Or did she kind of say, hey, are you going to marry me or not?
No, you know, I mean, the reason we got married, you know, I mean, obviously, we're still married. To be married, you had to be in love, you had to respect, you had to deal with so many difficulties and a lot of happiness and different type of life. Baseball is not an easy life to be a wife.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think the worst thing about being baseball, be a wife and be a son or daughter. That's the worst thing ever. Because really, your parents and your dad's never there for you. And, you know, your husband, you're never there for her in the big days, special days. That's people don't realize that.
Yeah.
How hard it is to be in the game. People, every time you play baseball, people think about how much money you make and how famous you are and what this and what that, but they never take the real life. Be honest with you, we never live the real life. That like everybody, I never changed my life. I never will. And meanwhile, it's a lot of missing stuff out there. You know, you hear the speech in everybody in Hall of Fame speech. They all say the same stuff. You know, thank you to my wife because dealing with my kids. Thank you to my kids to support. I know I wasn't there for a lot of things. That's it was. You know, what I mean, then I started playing Ozzie Jr. born when I was in Preden. I had to say, I had to be the who I am right now.
You always had your kids around. You actually had to fire one of your kids. I mean, so you kept them around the team. Would you do that any differently if you had to do it again?
With my kids?
Yeah.
Nope. They are my kids. They are my blood. And that's the only thing I really have. Everything else is part of life. But, you know me, I think my kids, myself, my grandkids now, my wife, we all together, we've been together for the good and the bad of life. And one thing about it, you know what I mean, baseball, you know, everything goes through life. It goes by, and sometimes you're famous, sometimes you don't, sometimes they miss you, sometimes they don't, you know what I mean? But family is going to be there forever. And I think we have, you know, we was five, now we're six. We're together for everything, and we help each other. You know, we're so close to each other. Sometimes I worry, something happened to them or something, but in the meanwhile, thank God my wife raised a good kids. Now, I don't think they was perfect kids. But I'll be honest with you, any father wish they have kids like mine. I don't have, the headaches I have, it was very small headaches. And the thing I had to worry about it, it wasn't something. Now, by the way, I learned from my kids a lot. And it's a family. As a family, I'm very happy the way we grew up, the way we stick together, the way we worry about each other, day in and day out. We care about each other, and we always be like that.
What's one thing that comes to mind that you learned from your kids?
I learned from my kids is life is not easy. It's not easy to be out again kids.
Yeah.
Sometimes that help to be my kids, sometimes not. And it's always going to compare them with me in baseball or in the field or off the field. And, you know what I mean? And you know what I mean? My kids, they all went to school. I never went. Their English is a lot better. My English not. They're going to raise better kids than me because they prepare for that. They have a good school. They see his mother raise them. And I think they got a lot of advantage on me, and I think they're going to be in life. They should be better than me.
You weren't going to school as a kid, or you just weren't getting the quality education that your kids got. Big difference.
Either way, I was lazy. I don't have money, and I went to sixth grade.
Wow.
Some people don't understand. Wow, a guy with sixth grade went and managed the big league club, working on TV. I speak very broken English, but people understand what I'm saying. My life's been so good with the education and where I come from. It's funny. Life is funny. People, I don't know why they judge me when they don't know me. You know, I pay my taxes. I never had drink and drive. I never beat my wife. My kid always to school. You know, in the balance in my life, you put my life in the balance. My life is so positive, so good. And some people misunderstand or don't like the way I am or what I do or what I say. But if you close your eyes and look at my coach, and you see my coach, and you say, like, wow, this is, you know, I'm just being honest. I learned that from my kids too. My kid told me, be honest in this country. People think, oh, just be honest, let's be honest. But when you're really honest, you get in trouble. Then you don't know exactly, confuse a lot of people. When I get to this, I told my kids, let's just be. Just be honest. Now I told my kids, just be honest and be careful. So because some people like to hear what they want to hear. They don't want to hear the truth. They don't want to hear what you think. People disagree with your mentality. Sometimes they say they respect what you think. They don't. It's a different life, different way it is right now.
It's interesting because you're saying being honest, and you were always a player's coach, and you always respected your guys. But sometimes you got to tell them stuff that they don't want to hear. I mean, how did you, I guess, establish that relationship that you could tell a guy perhaps something that he didn't want to hear, but that would...
They know I'm being honest, and whatever I say is going to be the best for him, not the best for me or the organization. And what I'm managing people, they know that. And I'm not just saying that just to say it. They know, and I show them. You know, you talk to them. You showed them who you are and what you do, and you move on. You know what I mean? Just the respect. You have to have a lot of respect for a player. He's a player. No, he's the best of players, man. And that's why I think I got more friends with my ball club than anything else. You know what I mean? You know, obviously, I got people that hate me. I hate him bad. That's nothing wrong with that. I don't like them. They don't like me. That's part of the game. But I think that great percent of the player manager do, they're good friends of mine.
Do you feel, as far as White Sox fans go, Ozzie, do you feel respected, beloved? I mean, you know, from my vantage point, that's how they view you. But I'm curious how it feels for you now.
Well, when I was player, you know, sometimes player, you know, media and fans, they don't like you because what you do, you lose a game, but you manage them, they never gonna like you. Because you they put you in the process, you're gonna make a mistake or something happen on the field. Some people are gonna be upset, some people are gonna be sad, some people will be pissed, some people are gonna be happy. At least you're not winning. At least you're not winning, you're always gonna be second guess. And telling you know, right now in Chicago, everybody loves me, everyone. And I told people, say, yeah, because I'm not the manager, the guys love me. I'm making fun of them. But hey, when you're managing, you got to have a thick, or GM, you got to have a thick, very thick skin. It's, especially in Chicago, it's not, you're not going to make it. You're not going to make it. You know, I mean, Chicago is very, I don't say tough, very, they push you to the limit to be better. And the one reason I want to be better is to show people how good I was or how good I am. And that's why I love to be pushing every day and being guessing me every day and ask questions every day, just because negativity, it made me better. I took to be better every day. You know what I mean? When I signed professional baseball, I was 120 pounds. Nobody saw I gonna make it to the big league. I played so many years in the big league. When I was coaching, he coached me because the Marlins is a bad team. And then whatever, we win the championship. When I'm managing, this is a PR department, this is marketing. We went to the World Series. I think I got a great success as a manager. When I got married, I will get divorced in 2 weeks. I still married. You know what I mean? When I had kids, so the kids will be the dumbest and they will do whatever they want because his father is crazy. I got my kids all the way to school, very good life. Then, you know what I mean? I like to prove people wrong. I love to prove people they're wrong what they think about me.
All right, Ozzie Guillen, we will continue the conversation as we'll get into Ozzie proving people wrong and whether or not he wants to get back in baseball. Ozzie, one of my favorite people. We'll do a little bit more with him coming on back here, 720 WGN. Continue our conversation with Ozzie Guillen. A lot of people being critical of Ozzie and taking on all that heat as a manager and as a player. How did he learn to handle all the attention, some of it positive, some of it negative, that he was getting?
Well, you know what? Yes, you know, especially where you come from. I come from out of nowhere and learn English, come to a different country, come to different thought, law, different thing in your life and change your life completely to survive in different countries. It's not easy. You know, the biggest compliment I got in the last couple of years, man, I went to Hall of Fame to see Harold Baines, and every player I say hi, they hug me. Every player, even the big unit, I thought big unit hate me when we play against each other. And he hugged me and said, when you gonna come back in the game? When you gonna come back in the game? Wade Box, you know, Gene Rice, you know what I mean? Oh my God. Oh, well, I know Cheaper and Matos or Gravin that played with him. But, you know what I mean? Guys like I play against them, they ask me, we need you in the game. They need the game. They need you. Then I was 35. But in the meanwhile, I almost started crying because I was going to feel like, God, if these people know the game, they want me back. Why the people, you know, the people have the power, they don't. And, you know, Danny Eskley, even, you know, last night, yesterday, I see Jim Leland. So Jim Leland here in New York, the first question he asked me, when you going to go back in the game? I said, well, my door is open. Then I don't know their doors, the people's doors, they are open yet.
For you to go back, would you have to manage or would you take a coaching job?
It depends. Coaching job, you have to be in Chicago.
Okay.
I don't say it have to be. It better be in Chicago because my family, all my family is there. You know what I mean? Coaching is not easy. Coach is a very demanding job. Not because I'm better than the other coaches. I never feel that way because I see a lot of coaches out there. They're awesome. But, you know what I mean? It's just a lot of working. Sometimes when the thing don't work the right way, it's coach's fault. It's never the player's fault. Never. It never will. I play the game. And I can't say that because I play the game. I don't say that because I finished my career as a manager. No, I play the game. When the players don't play good, the manager get fired. When the players don't hit good, the team coach get fired. Well, some places, some other places don't, but when the pitcher not good, you know what I mean? They don't fire the players. They fire the guys who work with them. And that's the way it was. That's the way it is. And that's the way it's going to be. I just can't know how to change that. Believe me.
I'm just thinking back to when when Jerry and Kenny hired you, they knew that if they're hiring Ozzie, he's going to say stuff, and they might not like it at that moment, but you're getting the whole package. It's part of you. It's why you're so good at your job. But maybe it's holding you back. I guess other people are, well, we can't take that on. We can't handle him. I don't get that, but do you think that's the main thing that's in front of you? Because, hey, look, you won a World Series here. The players loved you. The only thing that I could think that's in your way is people like, well, I don't think our organization can handle Ozzie.
Well, that was in the past. I'm different Ozzie now. And I got to say, you know what I mean, I'm changing on the field, but I know how the thing works now. You know, before I was, 40-something years old?
Right.
Managing a group of guys, managing the team. A really pretty tough organization, pretty tough city. We the fans hungry to win. And you know what, easy for me. I was managing, look at the team I was managing. Very controversial player. Very tough guys. Now then, to me, managing is easier now. Managing is so easy now. You just got to do that easy on the field. It's always been like that. But off the field, you know what I mean, you listen to the people. You go with the flow. And you're going to say what you like, what you not. Before, it was back and forth, from office manager, from office, from office player, manager. You know, it was like that. Now, it's a different game. Now, it's a different game.
Well, a lot of these organizations now, Ozzie, it seems like they have all the numbers, and they say, look, the lineup tonight should be this because this guy hits this against a lefty, and this guy's great in these win conditions or whatever data they have. I mean, would you sign up to be on board where, like, you're getting the lineup from the front office? To me, like, if I'm a manager, I wouldn't want that. But it seems like that's going on in the game all over the place.
Well, you know me, I don't know because I never did it before. I think Kenny Williams, they had all respect, and Jerry, and I think one of the biggest problems I had with the Marlins was kind of there because then we don't have the numbers on it. Numbers have been numbers for a long time. If you talk about numbers, why Joey Coronado managed in the big league? What's the reason? He's the best prepared coach in baseball, and he don't have a job in managing. His brother does. But he just, if you give me a good numbers, I think I will listen. I will agree. Yes, I will agree. I will disagree. Yes, I will disagree. But it's not fair. It's not fair that you give me a lineup and a plan, then when you lose, you're going to blame me.
That makes sense.
That's not fair. Right. Because if I go to the job, I say, listen, I'm going to be managing, but the lineup be made by somebody. Well, when you're going to talk to me about the lineup or about the team, you better talk to the guy who made the lineup. That's, to me, that's fair.
Yeah. Let's talk about this White Sox team before you got to get on out of here. What's been the biggest surprise for you this year? Is it Giolito? Is it the way Moncada has taken to third base and he's risen up? What's been the most pleasant surprise for you?
McCain.
Wow.
McCain, he signed with the White Sox to be a backup catcher. Hopefully, can be a backup catcher. Hopefully. And all of a sudden, this kid, little by little, start sneaking in the lineup, look at what he was or what he is right now. You talk about Moncada. We expect that from Moncada. Saying Moncada was out of Cuba. Giolito, we expect that from Giolito because Giolito was a first-round pick. And Giolito, to me, got one of the best stuff in the game. You know, Anderson, he should be better. I don't think he got the pick yet to be what he is. But then to me, definitely, there's no doubt in my mind, McCann is just doing what he did, and that's the biggest surprise and great surprise for the White Sox. Can you imagine White Sox without McCann? Oh, my God. Disaster. They don't have a catcher. And to me, catchers is one of the more important things in the game.
There we go, our conversation with Ozzie Guillen. Give us some credit to James McCann on the back end. Always love chatting with Ozzie. Let's get a check of news coming up here at 3:30. 720 WGN, Mark Harmon in for Nick DiGilio. So one of my favorite people growing up was a guy by the name of Ronnie Lester. And I know that name rings a bell, especially with University of Iowa Hawkeye basketball fans and Big Ten fans. He was called the greatest player that Magic Johnson ever played against. That's what Magic said when he competed against him when he was on Michigan State back in the day. And that was back at Magic and Bird and Indiana State. And Ronnie's a Chicagoan. He grew up, as you'll hear, on the south side across pretty much from Comiskey Park at the time. And came from nothing. Rose himself up. And sort of a older version of Derrick Rose, as the knee never really allowed him to have the career that he deserved. He blew it out his senior year at Iowa, and the technology was not as great there. But Ronnie spent 25 years with the L.A. Lakers as an assistant GM, as a scout, and as a player as well. Won a championship on the bench. He had a 5-6 year NBA career, first with the Bulls and then with the Lakers. He was on the Lakers teams with Magic and Kareem, sitting on the bench, backing up, and got himself a ring. But so let's catch up with Ronnie now, and what he's doing now is he's entering his 60s.
I call it semi-retired. As I was saying, I worked 2015 was the last time I worked, so that's 4 years ago. I'd like to go back to work, to be honest with you, if I could find the position that that suits me. But as of now, I'm content with just kind of taking it easy, traveling a little bit, visiting my family, just hanging out a little bit.
I want to go through your entire chronology here, but just that you put that out there right now, what type of position would you be interested in?
Well, the last position I had when I was with the Lakers, and I worked for them for a long time, I was the assistant general manager, had an office position, and I liked the position. There's not many of those in the league. There's only 30 teams, so there's not many of those, and they don't change over very quickly. But that's the position that I would be interested in.
Why not with the Chicago Bulls? I think that's perfect for you.
I'm not sure they're looking for anyone.
I'm not sure either. But, okay, let's rewind back. You grew up Southside, the projects, Comiskey Park's across the street. What was that like?
It was, you know, I lived a place called Stateway Gardens, 36th and State, across the Dan Ryan from old Comiskey Park. And we used to see the Sox play occasionally. Saw the Cubs play a lot bit more because they were on TV all the time. You'd come home from school and turn on the TV and watch the Cubs. But growing up there was it was fun. We had a lot of fun. There were a lot of activities to do with sports, and that's how I got involved in sports. First of all, it was baseball. I played baseball for a couple years, discovered basketball, then football. We would change with the seasons. As the season came around, football season, we played football and basketball. Discovered basketball, and I liked it, of the three sports, and kind of stuck with it. Start playing in different leagues around the city, playing for different teams, and that's how I got started in basketball.
So you didn't, as far as your surroundings, were you fearing for your life daily? I mean, what was that part of it like?
I wouldn't say I feared for my life, but it was tough growing up. You'd get in scrapes almost weekly. There were a lot of kids around. There was a lot of mischief you could get into. So I was happy that I discovered sports, baseball, and then basketball in particular.
Was there anyone who you would give credit to that was kind of steering you that way?
Not really. I discovered the game. I liked the game. I would say, though, that the first coach I had was a guy from my junior high by the name of Michael Clark. And he was a teacher, a gym teacher at my junior high. And I played for his, what they call bitty basketball back then. You were 11, 12 years old. I think they call it Pee Wee League or something now. But it was called bitty back then. And I played with his team. We'd go to a park district where he worked after school, and we'd practice every day. And he really helped me, you know, as far as learning the game, learning the rules of the game, and being pretty advanced at an early age, I'd say.
Did you know at that time that I might have some talent to do something here?
You know, I liked the game. I liked playing. We were playing all the time. You know, anytime we had a chance to play, we were playing in different tournaments. He'd put us in different tournaments all around the city. And I thought I was pretty good. My teammates thought I was pretty good. And it was something that I wanted to continue pursuing basketball and see how far it took me.
Were you like, wake up 6 in the morning, I'm going to go out to the court right now, dribble?
Well, on my way, I had a basketball. I got a basketball for Christmas as a, I think I was about 10 or so. I would take it everywhere. I'd take it to school with me before school. I'd go and play on the courts, you know, half an hour. Anytime I could get some basketball in, I would play.
So before school, really?
Yeah, about half an hour before school. Yeah.
I mean, that's a beautiful thing. So you go to Dunbar High School, and you grew a little bit later, right? You were kind of a late developer, as they say.
Yeah, I was small. In junior high, I graduated from Douglas Junior High. I think I was about 5'5", because my mother's about 5'5", and I used to stand back-to-back with her, pretend I was taller, standing on my toes, you know. I was about 5'5", when I went to high school, maybe 115 pounds.
Right. I was 5 foot, 100 pounds as a freshman, so I would have killed to have been 5'5", 115.
Yeah, I had a growth spurt my sophomore year. After my sophomore year of high school, I grew like 7-8 inches over the summer. My knees were killing me all summer. I went back to school as a junior. I was like 6'2", you know, 140 pounds or so.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
And I know that junior team, you had some studs with you, so you were getting people the basketball.
Yeah, we were pretty good. I think my junior year in high school, we were one of the final four teams in the city. We played at the amphitheater. We got beat by, I think it was Morgan Park, in the playoffs that year.
And then senior year, you're going into your senior year, greatest player in Iowa basketball history, Big Ten, all that. You don't have to say that. I'll say it. And you're not being really recruited that much, right?
Not really. My junior year, we had two pretty good players that got scholarships to go to college, and they left after my junior year. My senior year, I was kind of the guy with a lot of experience. I don't think a lot of people had noticed me prior to that, but I had a big senior year, averaged like 27 points a game, that type thing, and all these schools started recruiting me all of a sudden. Iowa was the first school, in fact, to see me play in high school and started recruiting me, and I eventually ended up going to school there.
See, now I'm a Iowa graduate, not class of 1996. I was on the extended plan a little bit, but regardless, I'm assuming that a kid who's living on the south side going to Dunbar High School doesn't know a whole lot about Iowa City, Iowa at that point.
Not at all. You know, as a high school kid, I didn't know where Iowa was. It was a bordering state to Illinois, but I didn't really know it. I didn't start researching things until they started recruiting me and some other schools started recruiting me and how far away they were from home, stuff like that.
But you took to it right away.
You know, it took me a year, to be honest with you. Being an inner city kid, growing up in Chicago, going to Iowa City, which is a rural farming community, basically.
Yep.
It took me about a year to adjust to it. But after the first year, I spent most of the summers in Iowa City.
What would you say was the hardest adjustment? I mean, you're on all these farming, white folk, all that, and here you are, you know, inner city kid. You had the huge afro back then, I remember. So, I mean, and you're on the basketball team. You're standing out a little bit.
Yeah, it was. I would say the biggest adjustment was how slow it was compared to the city. You know, the city is hectic, and you got to have your head on a swivel, that type thing. And going there, it was much more calmer, slower pace of life, which I appreciate today.
And for the record, you might hear some sounds during the interview. We're sitting here at a park on the Chicago's north side here, sitting there looking out at softball diamond, which you actually have some softball talent in you. I know this from talking to people here. You enjoy it. At least you did in the past.
You know, I grew up learning softball. You know, softball, 16-inch softball is big in Chicago. And as a kid, that's all we, the first probably year or so when we moved to Stateway Gardens, I was probably 8 years old. And that's what everybody was playing. So I picked up the game and I played. You know, in the summer, they were playing almost every day. So I played for a couple years learning baseball, playing 16-inch.
My friend Ronnie Lester, one of the greatest players in the history of the Big Ten, greatest player in the history of Iowa basketball, and a local guy with us here on 720 WGN. 347, let's continue our conversation with Ronnie Lester, who's now at Iowa, and he's one of the best players in the Big Ten, and that is when the knee injury happened.
Right. I injured my knee my last year at Iowa, my senior year. I think it was about 8 or 9 games into my senior year, and I had to miss probably half of my senior year. I came back at the end of the year to play in the last, I think, 4 or 5 games.
But here you are, you're on the court with, you know, I mean, Hall of Famer, Isaiah, Kevin McHale, Hall of Famer, and you're playing with these guys. And what, I mean, I can you remember your mindset of being on a team like that as, you know, you're a junior heading into your senior year, and I'm sure you're dreaming about the NBA at that point.
I was thinking about it. I thought about coming out after my junior year, but I tried out for that Pan Am team, and there were some other great players on that team, as a matter of fact. Michael Brooks, who played at LaSalle, Mike Woodson, who played at Indiana, yep. Ralph Sampson was the other high school player along with Isaiah on that team. Sam Clancy was a great college player who didn't play in the NBA. He went on to be an all-pro football player. That's how big and strong he was. But yeah, it gave you some confidence to know that you could play with some of the best players in the country because you had to try out for that team. They brought in probably the top 75 or 80 college players, underclassmen college players at that time to try out for that team. And they took, I think they took 15 initially because they took a couple guys to stand by. But it was a boost to your confidence to know that you could play with those guys and make that team.
I looked at the numbers here. I mean, you were, I think you had a ton of shots. I mean, not the most on the team, but you were up there. So it wasn't like you were just hanging around. I mean, would you call it featured? I mean, what would you say?
You know, that team, it was an interesting summer, you know, playing for Bobby Knight, who was the coach of that team.
He got kicked out in the first game against the Virgin Islands?
I don't think it was the first game, but he got arrested over in Puerto Rico. He may have gotten kicked out of that game, but he got arrested in Puerto Rico at a practice site, and that's a whole another story. But it was interesting playing for him. He was such a different coach that I had ever played for. You know, my high school coach was pretty mild-mannered and laid back, and my college coach, Lute Olson, was the same way. And Bobby Knight, he's definitely totally different. So it was an adjustment to play for him on that team.
And we should mention, the assistant coach on that team was Coach K. So you got Bobby Knight, and you've got Mike Krzyzewski, and young Ronnie Lester.
Yeah, it was interesting. It was, you know, as you said, we won the gold medal, and that was the purpose of going over there and winning the gold medal. But it wasn't easy because Puerto Rico, where the tournament was held, they had a pretty good team. And most of their players were college players who played in the States here. And they had a big, big crowd there. So it was interesting. But it was fun to play something different than playing with your team, you know, playing against other players in a tournament like that and playing with other good players. It was a lot of fun.
Would you say Bobby made you a better player?
I wouldn't say that, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
I think Coach Olson made me a better player.
How do you do that? Let's give Lute some credit. That Hall of Famer.
Yeah. You know, Coach Olson's a class guy. And when he was recruiting me, he told me, you know, he wasn't sure what the future would bring, but he told me that they would make me a better player and that I would get my degree at Iowa, and I did both. So I'm happy about that.
You're not going to tell the Bobby Knight arrested story, are you, or will you?
I can tell you a little bit about it. As I recall, it's long ago. A long time ago, we were going to practice at a practice site. Everyone had these practice sites, and we had a practice site scheduled at a certain time. And we get off the bus to go into, it looked like, a school gym to practice. And there was a police officer there, and we were early. We were like 10 minutes early, and he wouldn't let us come in. We had to sit on the bus, and Coach Knight wasn't happy about that. We finally go in to practice, and we get in. We started practicing. He's trying to, you know, address the group before the practice starts. And there was a women's team that practiced just before us. I think maybe the Brazilian women's team or something. And they were getting ready to leave, and they were chatting and making a lot of noise. And Coach Knight was not into that either. So he tells Mike Krzyzewski to go over to the police officer. And this guy was a full-blooded police officer in the Puerto Rican police force there. And I don't think Coach Knight knew that. And the guy came over to talk to Coach Knight, and they got into a little exchange, and they were talking about the police officer said he was in charge, and Coach Knight was not into that. And they kind of got into a little argument face-to-face. And Coach Knight took his hand and pushed the guy away from him.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. And the guy said, "You're under arrest." I guess he had put his hands on an officer, and he tried to handcuff Coach Knight. And Coach Knight is, you know, he won't let him handcuff him. This guy calls in other security to come in to help him arrest him, because they put him in handcuffs, took him away, and he was arrested.
Was this covered at the time? I'm assuming it was.
It was covered. It was covered. Coach Knight got out in time, because we played a game that night. He got out in time to coach us that night.
That's a different cat right there. I'm assuming that you enjoyed beating Bobby then at Indiana.
Yeah. The story goes, before I got to Iowa, I guess they beat up on Iowa pretty good. I guess there was a game called I guess they had a thing at Indiana where if Indiana scored 100 points, McDonald's provided a meal and all of this. And if they held the opponent under, I think, 50, it was a total meal. You know, you get a burger, fry, a Coke, and all this. And that was the talk of the town when I went to Iowa my first year. Indiana beating us so bad. And so, yeah, Indiana was one of those teams, and all the teams in Big Ten, you didn't want to lose to anybody, really. But Indiana was one of those teams at that time. They were really, really good. They had won the national championship the year before. I think they were undefeated the year before. My senior year of high school, I remember watching the game where they beat Michigan in the Final Four for the championship. But Indiana was good. They were good. And it took a while for us to be able to compete at their level. But eventually we did, yeah.
So let's talk about the senior year. And I just feel pride, by the way, as a Hawkeye, just hearing you beating Bobby and that Hoosier team and the red and white warm-up jerseys, all of it. But your senior year, you were seven games in is what it was, and you're playing Dayton at the Dayton Classic, and you get pushed from behind, you injure your knee, and what I was reading about is that the people in Dayton told you that you should have surgery, and then you got back to Iowa City, and they advised you against it. So I don't know if you could rewind back time to that point. Is there anything different that you would have done?
Yeah, I mean, you can always look back and say I would have done something different. Yeah, I got back to Iowa City, and the docs there looked at me. And they didn't recommend surgery. They thought I should rehab. Because when I first got to Iowa, you take a physical, all athletes do. And they told me my joints, I had loose joints. You know, your elbows, your knees. And I didn't know anything about loose joints. They told me I had loose joints. So when I got back, I think they knew my history better than anybody. But I remember seeing the Dayton doctor when I hurt my knee. And he recommended that I have surgery. But the doctors there wanted to be more concerned when I got back to Iowa City and just kind of rehab it and see how it went from there. Yeah.
And so that process, then you get yourself back on the court right before the NCAA tournament. Your teammates are hanging around. You're no one's thinking that this team's going to the Final Four. I don't know if you had that thought process there, but then you're able to play the last couple of games, and then you guys make a run in the tournament. But you weren't 100%, right? Or were you?
No, I was probably, 70%, 75%. I played the last game. But before that, I played in two Big Ten games after my injury. I think I came back maybe in January, late January or February. I think I played against Minnesota and maybe Northwestern. And I practiced a couple days later and had another incident with my knee, sort of the same thing. Not as bad, but I had the same thing. And I rehabbed again, but the docs thought they should go in and take a look at my knee, see what was going on, and they did. I had a scope done in Iowa City, and there was a small piece of cartilage, as I recall, that they took out of my knee. I rehabbed from that, and then I was able to come back at the end of the year. I think we played Illinois the last game of the year at home. I came back in that game. We won that game in a very close game and got a bid to the tournament when they were only taking, I think, I want to say 48 tournaments to the team, right, to the tournament that year. They've since changed it, but I think if we'd have lost that game, we'd have probably been in jeopardy of not making the tournament. We won that game, got in the tournament, and, you know, had a good run.
And you're in the Final Four. Well, here, before we get to the Final Four, I was reading your teammate wrote about coming back during the tournament, and you guys are you're at the old Iowa Fieldhouse, which was a sweet place. I don't know. Do you know what story I'm about to tell here?
The fans.
12:30 at night. You guys are in the training room. You think you're going home. You're all exhausted, and you come out, and all the fans are there at 12:30 in the morning / night.
Yeah, it was unbelievable. But that's how the Iowa fans are. They're some of the best fans, very supportive. That's how they were. We had just won in Philly. We had beat, I think, Syracuse and Georgetown to get to the Final Four. And we go back to Iowa City. We fly back. And we think we're going, you know, it's, yeah, midnight or something. We think we're going to the dorms. We're going to go back to the dorms. Everybody's beat. We've been on the road on the weekend playing two tough games, and it's midnight. They tell us to take our bags to the locker room, and players were grumbling about that. You know, we're going to go to the dorm. It's 12 o'clock. So we take our bags to the locker room. We come out to go to the dorms, and the arena's full. People's full, and it's a circus. And even before that, we landed at the airport, and there were all kind of people at the airport. There were people lining the road leading up to. Everybody couldn't fit at the airport, so they were out in their cars lining up. It was unbelievable. It was an unbelievable sight. Yeah.
So there's my conversation, or part of it, with Ronnie Lester. If you want to hear the rest of it or any of the other interviews I'm doing, check out On the Mark with Mark Harmon. That's the old podcast. You can find that anywhere, your iTunes, wherever you listen to podcasts. That's where you can get some more Carm if you so desire. And thanks to Ronnie for coming on. Just a class act. One sort of a guy that doesn't get talked a whole lot about in the city, and just a tremendous success story coming out of the projects on the South Side back in the day, and having a phenomenal, phenomenal career. 720 WGN. Mark Harmon with you. Nick D off tonight. All right, Vic, you've been reporting on this lead story all night. The Gilroy, the city of Gilroy shooting at this festival. At least three people are dead, including a 6-year-old boy. 11 have been injured. Anything further developing right now?
Well, right now they've been quiet. The last we heard, Mark, was a late night news conference. It was the first that they had held since the shooting earlier in the evening during the daylight hours. But late night news conference last night. It was around 10 o'clock local time in Gilroy, California, outside San Francisco. And the police chief in Gilroy said one thing that was notable. The one thing that was kind of breaking news during that news conference, which was that they are looking for a possible second suspect. That's on witness accounts that said that there may have been someone helping that person.
Right.
Okay. So that was the main takeaway from that news conference.
Okay, so we have one shooter, potentially two shooters, and we have three people dead. We have 11 injured.
The numbers on the injured are a little, they're different, and we're getting different accounts. So last night during the news conference, he mentioned a different number, so I'm going to just exercise caution with the numbers, but we do know at least four killed. That was three victims, one shooter. The suspect, according to the police chief, said one of his officers shot and killed the suspect. So one suspect killed, definitely three other victims at least have since died. There are at least a couple of the victims still in critical condition this morning, and we have heard that one of them is a child that's in the hospital as well. But again, the numbers on the those shot we're still waiting for official word because we don't know yet. They haven't released any of the identities officially.
Okay, Vic, great stuff. I appreciate it. I don't know about great stuff. That's the wrong way of saying it. I appreciate the information. The Gilroy Garlic Festival is Northern California. It's close to San Jose. I just think we're in a dangerous time, so I want to bring it up here. Tom, we've been sitting here all night. We don't even mention it because it is so common, right? And I just think that's we've just gotten to a dangerous point where we're totally desensitized to what's going on, and It's concerning. I mean, I'm looking at the website for the Gilroy Garlic Festival. Delicious garlicky food, signature cocktail, visit the Gourmet Alley. The heart of the Gilroy Garlic Festival is the Gourmet Alley, where the world-famous pyro chefs put on a spectacular flame-up show while hundreds of volunteers prepare all the official food of the festival. Enjoy live entertainment, three entertainment stages, strolling musicians. You're never far away from the great sounds of jazz and rock and roll, country, blues, reggae, swing, and more. So people are coming out here with families. It's a festival. It's in Northern California. I mean, I'm looking at the pictures here of what they're selling. It looks beautiful. Jean shorts, long sleeve shirts, music, drinks, food, people having a good time. And you come on out, and you end up in the middle of a mass shooting, four dead, 11 injured, and you know, everybody goes about their business, we go along with their lives, but you know, it's just, and then it's never the same for some. You just lost a family member, a six-year-old kid, everybody moves on in life, but you never recover from that, right? And we just keep going along. It's just a part of living in this country that it almost feels like we've just accepted it, and you hope that it's not you.
Well, I mean, on a certain level, everybody has, like, collectively, people have to keep on going. You know, it's obviously tragic, but as with any sort of tragedy, you have to keep on going. But I don't know when. So for me,
yeah.
Sandy Hook happened at the end of my first semester of college.
Okay.
And I was literally bags packed waiting to go home for holiday break for like Christmas. And I was watching it with my roommate unfold on television. And obviously I grew up in a time like I'm post Columbine.
Right.
You know, that was just something that was in the zeitgeist. But I don't know. At that time, I was 19, and I just said to myself, like, if this is really what it's come to, is children,
right,
and an elementary school,
right,
is, you know, on what level can we even get back from that? Because really, nothing happened after as a result. You know, after that, you know, who would have thought that wouldn't be a galvanizing moment?
Right.
For a lot of people.
Right.
And I'm not trying to say that, you know, changes can't still happen. Of course they can. You know, this is America. Like, that's what we strive for, is to just kind of make things better for ourselves when we can. But I don't know. Just sitting there at 19 years old and then watching over the next, you know, year or so as really nothing changes, nothing happens. Like, if this is what we're if we're willing to put up with that, I really don't like, everything's game.
Is it just because we all live in our own bubbles, and it's something that, like, it's taboo to admit that, you know what, I really only care about myself and my family and my friends, maybe, and my wallet, and I don't really want to be bothered in getting myself super informed on who's advocating for whatever gun control I feel is correct. I don't want to do all that research and then go out and vote. And maybe I'll vote in the presidential election every 4 years, but actually to be involved, it's just too much for me. I don't want to deal with it. I mean, I think that I mean, maybe people aren't saying that out loud, but I think that's pretty clear that that's how we have chosen to go about our business, and basically just, you know, closing the eye and hoping it won't happen to you or me. I'm not saying that I'm on any big pedestal here either. I'll talk about it on the radio, but I certainly could do more. You're talking about Sandy Hook. Do you know how many? Guess how many shootings we've had at United States schools so far this year? We're in July.
I'm not even sure if I want to guess.
22 is the answer. Geez. 22. Now, okay, they're not Sandy Hook level, but does it really matter? July 11th, a couple days ago, Hartford, Connecticut, man 34 yep. is riding his bike through a high school parking lot he shot at, died from injuries.
Mm-hmm.
July 2nd, Anchorage, Alaska, 22-year-old teenager at a basketball court in an elementary school, fight breaks out. Teens transported to hospital, life-threatening injuries. July 1 in the Bronx, 13-year-old shot in the chest at the School of Science and Applied Learning's playground. Kids at a playground at the School of Science and Applied Learning's, and he gets shot in the chest. Flint, Michigan, June 21st, 15-year-old student critically injured, shooting in a parking lot outside Carmen Ainsworth High School. Incident happens after a fight amongst a dozen of students. June 6th, right here in Chicago, 25-year-old man playing basketball at Genevieve Melody STEM Elementary School. Shot in the leg. Okay, 25-year-old. He's not in school, but this is school property. And just all, May 17th, student was shot at a spring football game, Terry Parker High School. That's in Jacksonville, Florida. And on and on and on. And I'm not sitting here, you know, with huge answers other than be more involved. But I just, you know, can we care just a little bit more and realize that this is not normal, that this should not be happening, that we are, if we do nothing, that's almost like we're complicit. And eventually, the odds are, it's unlikely, but eventually, at some point, it is going to hit closer to home. And at that point, that's maybe when we'll start to care. But just to not even, I was just thinking to myself as we're sitting here listening to the news, to not even speak about yet another incident where people are going to a festival to eat food and have a drink and listen to music, and life just changed forever. It's brutal, for lack of a better word. Just absolutely brutal. WGN, Mark Harmon in for Nick DiGilio, who's out sick tonight. Hopefully he'll be back tomorrow. And we are just delving into the shooting at a festival in California. 4 killed, including the gunman. There's another suspect, potentially. A bunch have been injured. And we just, you know, these stories just kind of like roll off our back, like, you know, just another one. It's day in the life, being an American. It's what happens. What can we do about it? 312-981-7200. Tom, you got a thought here before we go to the phones?
No, you go on over to the phones.
All right. Mac, Welcome to WGN. Go ahead.
Thank you very much. Thank you for hearing my call. Now, this is the only thing. We've got a helpless situation. We don't know when somebody who's mentally unstable or isn't mentally unstable, some copycats, it can happen anytime. It can happen in the afternoon. It could happen somebody just standing up walking and starts to shoot and shoot. It's the same way. They got 14-year-old kids out in these gangs with guns. So, you know, it's just like when Lori Lightfoot says she's going to do this and that. I said, you got to be kidding. You can't do nothing about the gang situation unless you really knuckle down. But, you know, it's a helpless situation in a way, and especially when you got some guy lurking around. You know how many weapons he's got on him, and you don't know where he's standing, you know. And if it's not guns, it's going to be something else, maybe a stick of dynamite.
All right, Mac, I appreciate the phone call. I don't agree with you. I'm not saying there's easy solutions out there. But I think there are things that can be done. If you're talking about the gang situation in Chicago, if we're going to go specifically there, I think there's a lot of things that could be done in rough communities like Inglewood or wherever you want to pick. There should be more after-school programs. Kids should have some place to go after they're done with their day at school. The school should be better, period. But give them a place to actually go. And what I would also encourage in that situation is that you have the police in those communities partake in the after-school programs. So you actually start to build a relationship between the community and the officers who are in charge of protecting them. So it's not just like, you're a cop, you're bad, or you're a kid who is going to school here, who's going to do something terrible, and I'm in harm. You have to build a bridge between the police and the community, and that is not an overnight thing. It will take time. But what are we going to do? We're just going to completely throw up our hands and say, this is the way it is. There's nothing we can do. And as far as mass shootings go, we as a country, we support strengthening the gun laws. That is, it has overwhelming support. But for whatever reason, there hasn't been the commitment to take on the NRA properly and get it done. But it's got to happen. And if we just continue along and say, you know, let's pray for the victims and whatever, it's just we're not doing our part. More needs to be done. And again, nothing is going to be overnight. It's not going to happen tomorrow. But you can't just you can't throw up your hands and be like, there's nothing we can do. Eventually, if that's the case, it's going to come back to you. More people need to own it. 847's texting, and Mark, the issue is with the court system. The vast majority of gun offenders are repeat offenders. The community chooses not to call these offenders out, and they don't want the police to help. See, okay. I think you're hitting on you're making a fair point, but you can't tell me that the majority of people in the communities that you're referring to would don't want those people on the street. Right? You're a law-abiding citizen. You're living in a rough community. Do you really think that they want that level of danger around them? They don't trust that anything's going to be done and it's going to come back at them and that they're going to end up losing their own life. But it's not something that they don't want. There needs to be better communication. More trust. And again, that does not happen overnight. Let me get Brent in here. Brent, welcome to 720 WGN. Go ahead.
Yeah, good morning.
Good morning.
You know, I'm just curious if, you know, is stricter gun laws really the answer? I mean, Chicago already has some of the strictest gun laws in the country. and it doesn't really seem to be effective. You know, I like more about what you're saying about community, getting the community involved. This is a people problem. This isn't a gun problem.
Well, it's both, Brent. I'm all for make the gun laws as strict as possible. If you got a felony conviction on your record, you cannot have a gun.
Absolutely, I couldn't agree more.
Right, and I'm not saying that's going to solve all the problems. Clearly not, but it's got to be a 10-barrel attack on it in the community with the police, with the laws being strict. And Illinois has strict laws. Indiana doesn't.
Well, I mean, you look at the Rockefeller drug laws in New York. I mean, how much does that curtail drug dealing? You know, I mean, you know, we really got to look at this from a community standpoint and figure out how to get people involved.
Well, now you're hitting on a whole other level of conversation. Whereas, if you take out the money source in the community, and no one has the appetite to do this, but I'm of the mindset that if somebody and Brent, I'm going to put you on hold here. I appreciate the phone call. You know, marijuana is going to be illegal in this state. That's coming. Gambling's coming. You're telling me that if I have an interest in doing other drugs, that the laws are going to stop me from doing it? I don't believe that. It's not like, look, oh my God, sweet, marijuana is legal. Now I'm going to run out and just become a pothead. My habits aren't going to change.
No, if you didn't smoke pot before, you're probably not going to smoke a ton more now. You might feel like, oh, maybe I'll try it, because you're not going to get a ticket or get hit with a drug charge, but you're not suddenly going to become, you know, Jerry Garcia.
Right, and my point is this. Look, you legalize it, you tax the living bedaylights out of it, you have programs for those who get addicted. You have that in place. You take away that money source from the community who's fighting over drug turf. Well, now that's gone. Now what? You're gonna have, in my mind, you're gonna have more money. You're gonna have a safer community, and you're gonna hopefully and you know, you eradicate a lot of the issue. Now, there's another thing that goes on here. Whereas that's over there. It's not my problem. And that clearly has been the philosophy of this city for as long as I've been on the earth. I mean, when I was growing up, Cabrini Green was the danger. Now they moved out Cabrini Green. Let's just try to make it in one little part of the city where I don't go to and it's not my thing. And it's not right, flat out. And that's just one part of the gun issue. So, and as we see mass shootings at a festival, you're going to a festival to listen to live music on a Saturday night, Sunday night, with your family, with your six-year-old kid. Oh, yeah, no, the six-year-old's not coming home. I mean, just absolutely brutal. .720 WGN 434. Good morning. So after the show today, I'm heading out of town, going north,
going up the country
to the UP, the old Upper Peninsula. That's right, Tom. I'm going to tennis camp, where I will be along with my fiance, the only two adults there. I'm going to be playing tennis with 15, 16, 17 year olds.
What inspired you two to do this?
Well, we went last year. We had a wonderful experience. Enjoyed it. We got a head coach up there by the name of Bill Perlmutter, who motivates me to be my best, I suppose, in this Boyne Mountain situation. We were, you know, we're looking for a driving vacation, something that's not going to break the bank, and the UP's beautiful country. I am seeing a story today that does scare me just a little bit. A series of black bear encounters, including a woman getting bit through the tent she was in. Now, this is at Yellowstone National, where we're not going. but apparently people are feeding the bears human food, and then they're relying on the human food, and now they're eating humans through tents. Now, in this particular situation, the woman, she's laying in her tent. Can you imagine?
That's like, it's like the top 10 fears.
Top 10, right? Here you are. You're chilling out. You're in the wilderness. You maybe had a couple drinks. You're just sat by the fire. You know, you're with your loved one. Maybe you're with your friend. This was at Little Cottonwood Creek, which is a backcountry campsite. A black bear bit into a tent and bruised the woman's thigh. Fortunately for the woman, the bite did not break the skin. How does a bear's bite not break your skin? Apparently, it's some really like thick tent material, so the bear didn't like the tent.
Oh.
But that's terrifying. I was doing car camping up in Wisconsin. This is a ways back. And it's me and a couple of my buddies, and we're in one tent, and then another buddy and his dog's in another tent. We're car camping, all right? Uh-huh. It's like Devil's Lake or whatever. It's not...
Sure.
No bears are supposed to be around. But we're asleep, and then all of a sudden we hear a creature crawling around. And I'm not apparently the most wilderness intelligent human being. I'm hearing this thing crawl around, and I'm convinced that it's a bear. I got a bear on the campground because I'm here. And we had left food out. We perhaps maybe had one too many drinks that night where we didn't, this is back in the day when I, would maybe go do things a little bit more. A little bit more loose. This would never happen nowadays for real. But anyway, but back then it did. And so we, left the Doritos out, left out the cookies, whatever we left out. And this thing is going to town. Just, you can hear it just eating our food, mowing away. And I'm like, this thing's going to come and he's going to rip my face off in my tent. I'm going to get bit on the thigh like this woman at Little Cottonwood Creek. And my other friend in there, he's as equally inept as me. And he's like, what do we do? And I'm like, we just pray. We're going to be able to just pray. Let's, the Almighty's going to save us here. And then my buddy with the dog in the other tent, he wakes up. And I see him like flash his flashlight at seeing what's going on. I scream out at him, what's going on? He's like, I'm not sure. And then basically, the dog starts barking. And now we don't hear it anymore. We know that this animal has run away. So we get out of the tent, it's 3 a.m. I'm thinking a bear's around, and just the littlest tracks are on the picnic table and whatnot. It was a raccoon or something of that ilk.
Yeah.
Nothing. But I thought it was over, man.
That was going to be it.
Right.
I almost got set upon by wolves.
What?
Yeah. I was up in a place called Lac du Flambeau. Way, way north Wisconsin, Northwoods.
Okay.
And my friend's family has a bit of property there. So we were going, walking throughout some of the, where there's not any houses or anything like that. They call it like the back 80, because it's 80 acres of just really nothing. And it was getting close to dusk. It was that kind of twilight time. It's a little foggy, The stars are starting to come out, but not quite yet.
Right.
And we walked through this trail that was pretty clear, but still quite thick with brush. And we get to a clearing. And we start to hear in the distance, some howling. But it's clearly pups. It's clearly not full-grown wolves.
I would not know the difference, and that would not work for me. Yeah. It's just pups. That would not work. But no. Go ahead.
But we were listening to them. And I turned to my buddy and I was like, hey, should we be worried? Are we a little too close to their territory here? And he says, well, no, I was told once that you really only need to start to worry when you don't hear the howling anymore. And I said, why is that? Well, it's because the parents have come and they've quieted the pups and they're going to go, they're telling them to be, get them to be quiet so that they can come check out what's going on.
Oh, God.
Literally, right as he says that, 5 minutes of silence. Like dead silence, you could hear a pin drop. And we were like, oh, yeah, we need to get out of here right now. So we rushed out of there. And
you're not sure that they were there, but
we had a feeling. It was that primal instinct, you know, when you don't know where it comes from. You've been living in modern civilization your whole life. You don't know nothing about the woods, but all of a sudden your caveman brain goes on and you're like, there are wolves here. We need to go.
See, I never would have. I would have been standing there. They would have come on up.
You would have been like, this is how it happens.
Yeah, right, right. I mean, I've had buddies who have like gone into Alaska and hiking trails, and they've
hunting wolverines.
Well, he wasn't hunting, but he was, you know, hearing bears running through the marsh coming at him. Boom, 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 boom. You can hear. What are you going to do? I'm asking. Well, what did you do? He's like, I got really big on the trail and said, "Go away, bear." That's
what you're supposed to do.
What you're supposed to do. Go away, bear. I'm like, the chance that I would hold my ground on a bear and not try to outrun and do some zigzag Carmen tennis maneuver side to side and get out of there, 0.0. Stand there and be tall and look the bear in the eye and say, go away, bear. No chance.
Well, I mean, like, what's your 40-yard dash? You know,
not fast enough, but I mean,
not faster than a bear.
I mean, but that's what he survived.
I do like that the phrase, the choice of words is "go away, bear."
Well, he understood. what else?
What else are you going to say to a bear?
Right. I mean, beat it would have worked.
You could say anything, really.
Isn't there a McDonald's around here that you can, you know, live the dream at there, buddy? You don't want to eat me. This wouldn't taste good. I don't know what we're going to see up in the old the UP.
I think you're going to see. I'd be more worried about getting dunked on by some 12-year-olds playing tennis.
Yeah.
If that's your choice.
That's possible that might occur. I play in a Saturday morning league called the Shoreline League. And this is rough and tumble suburban tennis. And normally I'm playing guys that were older than me, but I ended up teeing it up with a kid who's going to be a senior in high school this past Saturday.
Oh, okay.
So he comes out there. He's like 6'3". He's got the hat on backwards.
Oh, no. That's how you know he means business.
Yeah, he's ready to go here. This kid's not messing around. You on the team? Yeah, I'm on the team. Oh, really? Okay. You gonna play college tennis? Yeah. Okay. All right, good. You got college tennis on you, then you shouldn't be on this court right now because you're going to whip me. But so he starts playing, and it was like I was mirroring myself at that age as he's just melting down as things are not going well, and he's throwing his racket, and he's complaining to me about calls. Like, I'm calling balls out, and he's looking at him like, young man, would you like to come over here and see the ball mark? It is most definitely out. I'm not a cheater. My name is Mark Carmen. I host at 720 WGN. You can follow me on Twitter at the Carm. I am not cheating you, sir. But he was leading in the first set, and then he just completely lost it. And I wanted to, like, parent him. Hey, it's not easy when you're out there by yourself. Is there anything I can... You know, what's going on at home? What's going on at school? I know it's not easy being a seven, you know, going into your senior year. A lot of pressure. Where are you going to go to college? Do girls like me? Whatever's going on. Lots of stuff, right?
Yeah.
I mean, high school's not easy. But he didn't want to.
No, he didn't want you to come over and tussle his hair and call him sport.
Yeah, no, he was not feeling sport at all. He was,
no. That's all right.
I you know, the etiquette in tennis is after, if you... You know, you serve your first serve, and if it goes into the net, you're supposed to go. A lot of guys, you know, you'll go and you'll pick up the ball, get it off the court.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, I was tired. It was hot out there, so I let the ball stay on the court. I serve the second serve. He hits it out. He's irritated. He's looking at the ball on the court. I'm like, did that bother you? Would you like to replay the point? And he's, no, man. Okay. You do not like me right now. Lesson, but I will be experiencing the high school kids coming up here. I'll have a full report for you, Tom, coming on back here. I know you'll be interested.
Can't wait. Okay. Can't wait.
Nah, I love the Bengals on a Monday morning. Just another manic Monday. It's what we do here. Just look at the way Thomas just ties in the tunes with the moment of a 4:49. Good morning, Monday morning. Be your best today. Get your week off to a phenomenal start. Mark Harmon in for Nick DiGilio. Nick D under the weather. Hopefully he'll be back this evening. Couple of stories as we get on out of here. Number one, Tom Husch, do you play Fortnite?
No.
Do you know anyone who plays Fortnite?
Yes.
Do you know what Fortnite is?
Yes.
So, can you explain what Fortnite is to the masses, please? I know it's a video game. That's all I know.
Yeah.
And it involves guns and you shoot things and kids play it and they sit at home and there's other people playing it and that's what I know.
It's just a battle royale.
Battle royale.
100 people enter, one man leaves.
So, Fortnite is giving away $3 million. $3 million to the first ever solo world champion. He's 16 years old from Pennsylvania. You have got to be kidding me.
What do you mean you got to be kidding? What's there to kid?
A 16-year-old playing a video game is getting paid $3 million. That is an alternative universe that cannot be real.
Tell the 17-year-olds who are making literally millions upon millions of euros playing soccer in Europe.
Yeah, that's... Okay, hold on. Young kids have been playing soccer and tennis and making dough since many, many years, Tom Husch.
True.
Video games. Like, when I was a kid, I was playing Pac-Man, Centipede, Galaga, Donkey Kong.
We're way past that.
Burger Time. Nobody was paying me $3 million bucks to win a Burger Time tournament at the local.
Because you weren't that good at it.
Well, I wasn't, but that it didn't exactly. Burger Time was a tough game.
That's true.
Let's see here. Beating out the pros and famous streamers, Kyle Booga. He's got a nickname, the Booger. B-U-G-H-A, Gersdorf, 16. Made a name for himself by dominating from the first round and ultimately taking home the $3 million grand prize, the largest ever payout for a single player in an esports tournament. And maybe I'm a get-off-my-lawn old man over here in my mid-40s.
You might be.
Look, you wouldn't be getting the dough if the dough wasn't there. I get it.
Mm-hmm.
But that is crazy. After securing victory in the first round and 9 in-game kills. I mean, Gersdorf did have 9 in-game kills. So let's not poo-poo that one. He went up to rack up dozens of in-game kills each round. He ended up with 59 points, huge lead over the second-place winner. And, I mean, people are tweeting this. This is the future. Our 16-year-old player just won $3 million. Can you imagine being 16 and you just got $3 million? $3 million, you're 16.
Mm-hmm.
You can't drink. You can barely drive. Your parents are probably out there working their behinds off, and maybe they're making, I don't know, close to six figures, maybe, if they're lucky. And you just pulled in $3 million bucks. Here's Gersdorf. Words can't really explain it. I'm so happy. Everything I've done in the grind has all paid off, and it's just insane. Everything I've done in the grind. In the grind. Like, he's just been going at it and going at it for years and years and years and battling his way. And then finally, when he got to 16 years old, he made $3 million. I don't want to say that he doesn't deserve the dough, because clearly he does. But that's just... That's incredible. The second place person was a 24-year-old by the name of Harrison Chang, who's a former professional Heroes of the Storm player. He won $1.8 million. $1.8 million for video games. This is again an alternate universe. Speaking of youth and not an alternate universe, Leonardo DiCaprio. Congratulations to him, I suppose. He's dating his girlfriend now for well over a year. Her name is Camila Maroney. And they have a 22-year age gap. Leonardo is 44. Maroney is 22. And this, for whatever reason, makes people incredibly jealous. And they think that Maroney is just going after Leonardo's money, and that Leonardo is using her, and that Leonardo just likes young women, and that Leonardo's going to dump Maroney, and Maroney's going to should just enjoy her time in the sun. And that she's being used. So you've got all these people on Instagram commenting at this 22-year-old girl who's just having a day, who's just dating DiCaprio. You only have a couple more years before he dumps you, girl. I mean, that's what they're right.
I'm sorry. I like the way that you. Very good line reading.
This is, you only have a couple more years before he dumps you, girl. At Vegan Cow commented. It's a very interesting handle, at Vegan Cow.
I like it. That's ironic.
And then
yes.
At KA.TH22 added, oh, please, what he has with you is not love. He's using you. And so Maroney, who's this 22-year-old girl, she's dating Leonardo DiCaprio. This is legal. She doesn't need to be getting date-shamed by everybody on Instagram. Of course, it's the world we live in. She writes, good morning, people, and happy Friday. I read some of the comments on my Instagram, and my God, people are so mean and full of anger with people that they know nothing about. I guess I just hope on this Friday that people learn to live with a little less hatred and place their time and interest elsewhere, because living without hatred feels pretty good. Okay, now, I would like to just name that. I'm sure, Camille, you have a little bit of hatred in you, too. We all do. It's okay. This is part of the human experience. We don't love everything. I know that people don't want to use the word hate, but whatever you want to, whatever umbrella you want to throw that under. But more importantly, just let's be a little bit better. Do we really have to write at somebody that we don't know on Instagram and call her out? There's nothing wrong here. Leonardo, she is of age. Leonardo is of age. This has been gone on from the I don't know start of time. Younger men are interested in or older men are interested in younger women, and sometimes look, can go the other way.
Sure.
I know I have friends who are gentlemen who are married to older women than them, not necessarily 22 years older, but as we wrap up on this Monday morning, just leave Camille and Leonardo alone. I mean, when they think about what, you know, think about Leonardo in his past. If Kate Winslet in Titanic, you know, everybody's, if she really cared about Jack, would she have not made room on the floating board in the water to get him up there? Think about this going into your money. I mean, here, there's Jack in the water. It's freezing. And she's just laying on the, on
it's like a door.
On a door, a wooden door. And for some reason, she can't figure out a way to get Jack on there. Jack dies of hypothermia, and she goes on to live an amazing life. What kind of love? This is maybe the reason why Maroney, you know, DiCaprio has found Maroney. I don't know how you can tie that two together, but I just don't. You know,
I think it's funny that there's a lot of people who the comments seem to be coming from people who feel like they know Leo, like they're really like, right. I know what Leo wants.
Right.
I know what he needs.
I saw What's Eating Gilbert Grape.
Yeah.
What's your Mr. Movie guy?
Yeah.
You and what's your favorite DiCaprio movie? Do you have one?
I would say probably either The Departed or
Phenomenal
or The Basketball Diaries.
I never saw Basketball Diaries.
Oh, wow. You're missing young Leo, young Marky Mark.
Yeah.
Very disturbing movie, but it's all true. It's a really, really great movie. But you're not going to watch it again for a long time if you get the chance, but check it out. The Basketball Diaries is a very good young Leo performance.
It feels very off that I've not seen The Basketball Diaries, being the basketball fan that I am, but okay. Basketball Diaries. It's on the list, Tom Hush. You got anything else I should be seeing before we get it?
Go see Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Everyone loves Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
I adore it. I think it's... I got the chance to see it again, and At first, I liked it. Now I'm really on board with this whole movie. Although, how do you feel about 3-hour movies?
I can handle 3-hour movies. And
it's a very interesting 3 hours. It's like a hangout movie, really. It's a lot of Brad Pitt and Leo DiCaprio just hanging out in Hollywood.
I'm fired up for the record for Top Gun Maverick.
No, I'll see where it goes.
Is Nick excited about Top Gun Maverick?
No,
he doesn't like Top Gun.
He does not like Top Gun.
Oh, come on, man!
Because I'll give you the same challenge that I give to everybody. What is Top Gun about? Not what happens. It's about the guy who's in the Air Force. Blah blah blah. No, what is that movie about?
It's about winning, Tom. It's about competition. It's about being your best. It's about risk. It's about love. It's about everything that matters in life.
That's the best answer I've received so far, and I've asked a lot of people about what that movie is about. So.
Oh, okay, I'm gonna feel good about that as I go into my Monday. Good morning, everybody. Have a great day. Steve Grzanich coming up with the opening bell.